Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason. Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Horse?
You know Morse code.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 13, Some Like It Hoth, and you cannot rewrite a Star Wars because Hurley's on it, but what are you writing in 1977? My name's Dave Gonzalez, I'm going to jumpstart The Matrix. 1999 doesn't need to be that long, we live in a simulation.
My name's Joanna Robinson, and I'm going to rewrite a bit of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not much, we all agree that is close to a masterpiece, but I'm going to go ahead and change Marion's age. I'm going to age her up a little bit. That's what I'm going to do.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I would be rewriting the 1980 sports comedy Caddyshack, because I think there's some good stuff in there. I would keep Rodney Dangerfield for sure, and the class comedy, but there's a lot of really terribly inappropriate stuff in that movie, and I could definitely fix it and it would age better.
The woke past way back from 1977. I like it, and I like none of us chose
Raiders could use one of those too,
right?
Yeah, true. None of us chose Game of Thrones. I feel like we just knew no one could finish that story, let alone try.
Even if George R.R. Martin was able to go back to 1977 and start over on Game of Thrones, he still wouldn't have finished. That's my theory.
Mm-hmm. He'd still be working on it.
Yep.
You're listening to a podcast about Lost. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. The podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. The first is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. It's named Calm in opposition to The Storm. We are hopefully energetic throughout the entire thing. The second section, called The Storm, is The Storm of Spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you should see time codes of when each of those sections start. You may notice the calm starts a little bit from now. That's because we got some business to discuss. First of all, thank you for supporting the podcast by just giving us a listen and sticking with us for almost five complete seasons of Lost. We don't have that much left in season five. It's been quite a ride, and pandemic's still going on. We enjoy your company. But if you feel like you need to support the show a little bit more in these trying times, absolutely. Go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. And not only can you figure out a way to subscribe to us and kick us a little something, but we will in return give you access to bonus content. Not only all the bonus content that we've amassed this entire time we've been doing a Lost Rewatch podcast, but new bonus content that comes to you every week. This week, we're going to have a mailbag where we answer some of our questions from our Patreon subscribers. We always are constantly have a Slack running where people and who listen to our show can discuss anything they want. And we have weekly watches of episodes of Lost and monthly movie watches. We just watched Mighty Ducks together and everybody got to quacking in the chat. It was fantastic. And there's a book club that Joanna runs where they read books that will eventually be turned into media, like, that Game of Thrones. We like to toy around the adaptations. Joanna, what's the update with the book club?
Oh, yeah. So, as I mentioned last week, we're reading Leigh Bardugo's Shadow and Bone. which has been turned into a Netflix series, which will air the end of April. We are discussing it on April 10th. That has been, that's an updated date. It used to be April 4th. We have moved it to April 10th for like weekend Easter time zone reasons. We're going to be talking 4 Pacific, 7 Eastern on April 10th about Shadow and Bone in our book club Slack. There's like going to be a Zoom call. We're on video. It was really fun last time. We're going to do it again. I have, since we last spoke on this podcast, I have read the book and watched the entire series, and I had a really good time. I think this is a series that if you started with on Game of Thrones with us, you're going to really enjoy this series. So read Shadow and Bone. If you have time, read Six of Crows, because that's going to help you with the TV show. And we love being smug book readers, don't we? We do. So join us. Get in the know. Get ready for Shadow and Bone. Ben Barnes is here. It's going to be great. All right. You can also always email us, hostedstormpodcast.com. We've got a couple emails to read here in the sort of calm way, and then we will have some stormy emails to read later. You can go to our website, stormpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at stormpodcast. That's where you can vote on history polls, among you know, all kinds of fun stuff happening over there. You can also leave us a review. We've got a couple of those. Thank you very much. And as Dave mentioned, we do live watches of every episode of Lost on Saturdays in our Slack. This week, Dave is hosting The Variable, which is one of my faves. And
the numerical 100th episode of Lost.
Can I say something about The Variable very quickly right mm-hmm. here?
Yes.
I watched it a couple weeks ago. I just kept watching, I think, after we were doing one of our live watches a couple weekends ago. I kept watching. And something to watch out for in The Variable, if you're not watching with us, if you're watching on your own, note how many times someone says the word time or a unit of time in that episode. I'm sure this is something that people have observed before. I just never noticed it, and it's like definitely a thing in that episode. So if you're playing a drinking game and you want to get tipsy, sip every time.
We're going to have to remember that for the live launch. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that's a tease for what's coming for The Variable. But we are here, of course, to talk about Some Like It Hot. We've got a couple great emails to read. And first, I'm going to hit those reviews. That's what I'm going to do first. You can always leave us a review. We really appreciate it. It means that more folks can find us. And like, you know, I know we're getting towards the end here, but more and more Lost fans are like finding this community every day. And that makes me really happy. Okay. So this first review comes from, Tittybone_Malone.
Ooh, yeah.
Okay. 5 stars. These guys get it. This is my first podcast review ever. That being said, I was compelled to give credit where credit is due. The Storm Gang makes me laugh, think, and most importantly, try new accents. They may or may not get me canceled. No, don't do problematic accents, Tittybone Malone, I implore you. Okay. I am rewatching Lost for the first time since its original airing and really loving this podcast as a companion piece. Thanks again for your commitment to the craft. Hashtag Team Sawyer. So that is one review.
I have a way around doing potentially offensive accents, which is you tell people, and then you do a phrase that is directly from a Warner Brothers cartoon character, which are all kind of offensive accents.
Okay. Oh, are you talking about a way to do Speedy Gonzalez?
You could do Speedy Gonzalez. You could do a stutterer, as long as you're saying, you know, that's all, folks, and nabadi, you know, you're not, it's
oh. You can do Pepe Le Pew and just really stick it to those Frenchies. All right.
Yeah, take that, the French. The French have been riding high for too long.
All right, and this review comes from the Piccolos. Pickle spelled like, you know, a pickled cucumber, Piccolos.
Oh,
from the
okay.
UK. From the UK. 5 stars.
Worst breakfast cereal ever.
5 stars. The Podstant. It's like the constant, but there's a pod.
Oh, yeah. There. I see what they did there.
These guys have been my constant during the pandemic. I started rewatching Lost very slowly before COVID hit due to school, but once it arrived and lockdown settled in, I couldn't wait to watch weekly with them. The hosts have amazing chemistry and are full of knowledge about Lost. A lot of it is all new information to me. The guests they get in the show are always great and really explain a lot of stuff well that I'd have no chance of understanding on a normal basis. They're coming up on one of my favorite episodes, The Variant. I think the variable is what he means, but that's okay. Which might be an unpopular choice for a favorite, and I cannot wait to hear them discuss it. I've never watched Game of Thrones, but I'm now tempted to do so, so I can listen to them explain it to me week by week, too. Keep it up and stay safe. So, wow, we might have gotten a Game of Thrones watcher. Out of
that's going to be a wild ride.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot. All right, then I'm just going to hit two emails before we dive into the rest here. The first one is about our guy Jack, who I must say, one of my favorite things, you know, rereading recaps from the day, is how much Alan Sepinwall hates Jack Shepherd. current Rolling Stone critic, renowned TV critic Alan Sepinwall really hates Jack Shepherd, which he has said on this podcast. Alan is, this is around the time when Alan is, he's warming. He's warming to Jack Shepherd.
Ooh, the humble Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Just so, erasing chalkboards and looking tired, putting on blue shirts.
So Sarah wrote us an email, titled, "We have to go back to liking Jack." All right. "Hi, Joanna, Dave, and Neil. First, I want to say how much I really love your podcast. Lost is my all-time favorite show, and I truly don't think another show will ever take its top spot in my heart. I'm so thrilled that you guys chose Lost as your topic after Game of Thrones, and I think it's so great that a new generation of people are getting into the show that maybe missed out on it when it was originally airing. Next, I want to say how great I think you all are. You all are fantastic to listen to, and I appreciate all that you put into doing this amazing podcast." There's a butt coming. It's okay, guys. "I don't want this to come across as a complainer, but if there's one thing that keeps me from enjoying this podcast as much as I would like to, it's all the Jack hate. My three favorite characters, in no particular order, are Jack, Juliet, Ben, and Sawyer." And then Sarah sent me a follow-up email acknowledging that she wrote four characters because she couldn't not include Sawyer. "And honestly, I really love all the characters so much. Although I know this is an unpopular opinion today, I do feel like all the Jack hate is unwarranted. Is he a flawed character? Yes. Does he act like a huge dick at times? Of course. Does he have control issues? Absolutely. However, this show is primarily about a group of people who are all flawed in different ways, and they all have issues to overcome. Part of the beauty of the show is watching that happen and play out. I personally wouldn't want to watch a show where the main character was perfect and did everything right and never rubbed anyone the wrong way. I feel like that would be a boring show and an unrealistic portrayal of human nature. I fail to understand, for example, how Saeed torturing / killing people, Sawyer using racially insensitive nicknames, or Desmond completely disregarding what the woman he loved wanted and instead setting off on some ridiculous journey to prove to her father that he's worthy of her is worse than Jack acting like a jerk or saying Juliet is under protection. Yet it seems like Jack is criticized endlessly for anything he does and everyone else is let off the hook. I do think that Jack, while obviously flawed, does try to do what he thinks is right in every situation. Just like Harry Potter, he has a saving people thing. Maybe he doesn't go about it in the best ways, but I don't think that makes him a bad person. Back in the day, I was a regular on Dark UFO, reading all I could after each episode. I loved the Doc Jensen recaps, etc., and I don't remember Jack hate being such a thing as you guys make it seem, as though it was. I remember Kate hate being a thing, not for me. I love everyone on the show, but I definitely remember that. Anyway, I'm probably rambling at this point, but I wish you guys would give Jack the same amount of grace that you give the other flawed characters on the show. I think especially considering how all this yada 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 yada. Thanks for reading this. Okay. So I have a couple things to say to Sarah. First of all, thank you for the email. Secondly, I think you're absolutely right. Jack hate wasn't, you know, other than Alan Sepinwall, as far as I know, Jack hate wasn't really a thing in a predominant way. So I'm sorry if we've ever made it seem that way. That is definitely sort of a 2020, 2021 reading more so than it is a contemporaneous reading. I think, and then I'll piggyback off another smart thing that Alan said when he was on the show before. I can't remember if we kept this part in the comm when he was here, but he was saying the reason that Jack frustrated him so much, it wasn't that Jack was a flawed character, because as you say, like, this is a show full of flawed characters. It's that Jack is, for much of the show, very rigid, like obstinate to change as a character. Whereas we see Sawyer growing, and that growth is satisfying to us. We see a lot of these characters go through growth. That's a whole point. You know, we see Jin go through growth. Like, that is the whole point of the show, is the growth. I don't know if it's spoiler to say that I feel like Jack is not done growing, and they've sort of saved his growth for the end of this journey here because he is the protagonist. And Jack gets really interesting to me right around here is what I'll say. So you will hear less Jack frustration for me because the character starts to go through that thing that I like to see characters go through. But I think my frustration is that for many, many seasons, he's so rigid in his, persona. Anyway, Dave and Neil, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. One, I don't disagree. First of all, I love that, Sarah not only brought a defense of Jack, which very well reasoned, but also came out swinging at some of our other faves and, calling them out for things that they've done. All of that's super true. I was thinking about this in the context of the other day, like I've sort of found some of the coverage I did of Lost at the time, which was like video blogs that we did on Film School Rejects that are definitely not on the internet anymore. I am going to be inspecting those soon. I'm going to try and sit down and like watch a bunch of them. So I'm going to report back as to whether I liked Jack at the time. I don't actually remember if I had any strong feelings. I will say this. The rewatch has given me an appreciation for Jack a little bit, but also I think what's annoying about Jack isn't necessarily Jack's character. It's the show's continued focus on Jack. Like, I probably would like Jack better if he were a secondary character and not like the core protagonist that the show keeps coming back to. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of my criticism of Jack, because otherwise I agree. He's a flawed character amongst many flawed characters. Everybody's got a bad dad. And, you know, so he's otherwise like not the worst character. He's fun to make fun of though, because of his rigidity, because of Matthew Fox's face, like all of it's fun to make fun of. So, you know, take it with it's sometimes it's in jest. Sometimes I'd just rather the show focus on someone else.
Yeah, I think a result of this podcast seeming like it's really anti-Jack is we're going episode by episode, and I think we hold people accountable for their episodes. There's a lot of Jack episodes, and a lot of them, especially in season 3, are shoehorned in. Even the show knows they're bad. So it's not the character's fault, it's not the actor's fault. It's kind of like the sum total of the show shows off some really bad Jack behavior. And not only really bad Jack behavior that they knew was bad at the time, but also Jack behavior because he's a white male born into privilege. And we've been thinking a lot more about that as we've been rewatching the show. His behavior looks bad at towards the beginning of the show, like pretty much worse than it would have been when the show aired. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also like not the show's fault. I think overall, if you were to read this email in the storm, let's say, I would be able to 100% agree with Sarah and be able to be like, yeah, wasn't it funny that we all got to rag on Jack when Jack was actually being bad? But in a calm way, I think we might accidentally seem like we're really anti-Jack just because we haven't seen the part that Joanna finds really interesting yet, which I also like find interesting. We're getting to the core, and if we had gotten there already, Jack would actually be boring. So I think we took the time and we took the thing, but as the protagonist, the entire narrative is based around like the tension of, are we going to like Jack? And if the show ended in a way where I didn't like Jack, we would be talking about the failure of this entire show's narrative arc in a Game of Thrones way, which I don't think we will.
And I think it's fine to end the show not liking Jack. And I think especially like in 2021, I think something that this is the conversation I'm seeing around Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where I was trying to find some like avenues. If you're not watching that show, there's a character played by Wyatt Russell called John Walker, who may or may not be the villain of the piece. We don't know. But like the show is trying to introduce some like slightly sympathetic angles on this character, maybe before he goes full bad, maybe who knows? We don't know. But there are some folks who are just sort of like, I have no time for this character type at all. I have no time for sympathy for this character type. Which is someone who is using their sort of like blinkered white privilege to muscle their way through things. And it's, I can draw a line between John Walker, who is in 2021 the villain of a show, maybe, and to Jack Shepard, who when Lost premiered was, you know, the protagonist.
Well, obviously that's the lead of your television show, the Matthew Fox white male doctor.
Like, right. So it's just,
look at this cast of other people.
Right. So it's just, you know, Lost did a lot of, like, for the time, a lot of extremely progressive stuff. I mean, like, you know, in this episode, if you look at, the bulk of the episode, it's like two Asian men and a Latino man, like, riding around in a car. Like, that wasn't, they don't need to get like a parade for me for that. But like, at the time, that wasn't what network television was giving us, you know? And so, you know, Lost was doing plenty of things in a progressive way, but, you know, it was a while ago that this show aired. So,
yeah. And I think it also, like, Saeed is written in a way to make us like him on the show most of the time. You know, shooting little boys aside, like, people are complicated. But a lot of that is also a result of, in the writer's room, they're thinking about that because we're in the Iraq war and in Afghanistan. Like, those are all current issues when this show is, like, airing. It's a contemporary, we can't wind down. Like, been through the early 2001 period of demonizing these people. So the writer's room was aware of it. Much like, I'm sure, if, you know, the writing team were to return and revisit Lost, like, a post-Watchmen, post-Leftovers Damon Lindelof would deal with a lot of these issues differently.
Mm-hmm. All right. We will be talking about Jack more as we go on, I promise. But this is one more email. This is from Harrison, and it's about Miles. It'll segue into this episode. Harrison here from Melbourne, Australia. I can't begin to express how much I've enjoyed your podcast over these past couple years. It's become a staple of my routine every week. A quick intro about this is, I thought this was fun, so I'm leaving it in. A quick intro about my experience with the show. Lost aired when I was a teenager, and at such a pivotal age, it really took a hold of me and is a huge reason why I became TV obsessed. I remember during season one in 2004, Australia was months behind the US airing of each episode, and without the internet of today, we were also free from spoilers. This is Joanna, which is funny because there were definitely Lost spoilers out there, but like, we just weren't, you know, the general populace wasn't just 24/7 online the way they are now.
There was,
you know,
no, I mean? Twitter, for example.
Well, my dad knew someone at the local TV station, and he was able to get the finale episodes, Exodus Part 1 through 3, on DVD weeks before they premiered. Safe to say, I was a pretty popular kid at school during those weeks with all the answers. So if you're wondering what the source of spoilers in Melbourne, Australia was, it was Harrison. Okay, that was me, Joanna. Okay, all right, back to Harrison. Okay, for the calm segment, I would like to briefly discuss Miles' classic line from the end of season four. What do I mean? In response to alluding to having spent time on the island before. In this most recent episode, it seems clear from flashbacks that Miles never knew about his father or the island when he was a kid or a teenager with a bad punk hairstyle. This begs the question, how did Miles know he used to live on the island? Is the assumption that he talked to a dead person who revealed this information to him? Or did he just find out off camera at some point? Boring answer. This isn't necessarily a game changer prompt, but it opens up fun interpretations or thoughts. I mainly just wanted to relive Ken Leung's line delivery of "What do I mean?" one more time while he's in the spotlight. Anyway, love everything you guys do. Thanks for doing what you do, Harrison. So, thank you for that, Harrison. So, let me start with Dave. Dave, what did Miles mean?
Didn't he find find out in line? Did I miss the question?
No, I think that the answer is in this episode, but
But he says it at the end of season four, so like he hadn't seen his mom in line yet.
But before he went to the island, he met Brahm, and Brahm told him he knew the truth about his father and the island and all that. So when he got to the island, he knew that he had a connection to it. I guess he may have not known exactly, but you know he had an idea.
I guess my mind sort of reversed this, which is on the official Lost podcast this week, Damon and Carlton said that they knew who his father was as soon as Miles appeared on the show. So that might factor into our discussion of this episode, but apparently there was a plan for Miles to, at that point, I guess, like, see a video of Dr. Marvin Candle or something. I don't know what the original plan was versus how it was executed, but yeah, mm-hmm. apparently at that point he would have, or at least the showrunners were making a joke because they knew.
Yeah, I think, and I also think that Miles had a lot more information right before he left for the island.
Hmm. What do we mean? Well, before we dive into the rest of that, Neil Miller, what did happen on Lost this mm-hmm. week?
Tons of things happened. Some Like It Hoth, this episode was directed by our friend and yours, Jack Bender, and written by Melinda Sue Taylor and Gregory Nations. This episode aired on April 15th, 2009. That was the first tax day of the Obama era. It takes place 3 days after the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn a significant amount about the life of Miles, who, as you'll remember, can communicate with dead bodies. We get some insight about the strained relationship he had with his mother, also the limits of his powers. For example, there needs to actually be a body present, and some of the reasons why he wasn't a big fan of his father. We also see how Naomi recruited Miles for the freighter team and learn that before heading to the island, he was approached by Brahm and his ridiculous statue question. Hank from Breaking Bad also shows up at one point as a grieving father. On the island, Horace needs someone for a secret mission, and because LaFleur is off saving baby Ben, he asks Miles to pick up a package from Redzinski and then eventually deliver it to Dr. Chang. Along the way, he picks up Harley as a co-pilot who makes a mean garlic mayo and can also, as you'll recall, speak to the dead. Harley very quickly realizes that there's a body in the back, and before too long, he also learns about Miles' two secrets, talking to the dead and the fact that Dr. Chang is his father. Elsewhere in Dharmaville, Roger finds out that Ben is missing and he's not handling it very well. After Kate tries to help, Pompa Linus begins crafting some interesting conspiracy theories. Later, Jack gives Roger a strong talking to in order to keep him from finding out the truth. Even later still, Dharma Phil figures out what happened to Tiny Ben and gets punched out by LaFleur. After delivering the sandwiches and the body to the Dharma crew at the Orchid, Hurley and Miles share an awkward van ride with Dr. Chang to the secret site of the Swan, where the Dharma crews are building the hatch.
Hatch.
On the way back to Dharmaville, Hurley admits that he's writing the script for The Empire Strikes Back, which hasn't come out yet in 1977, and that he has some very hot takes about Ewoks. This inspires Miles to give his father a second chance. It all ends back in Dharmaville, where Miles sees his baby self and realizes that he does, in fact, care about his father. He then drives Dr. Chang to the docks, where Daniel Faraday has just arrived on the sub.
Ooh, time, daddy!
Fun fact, this week's fun fact is more of a Star Wars fun fact for anybody.
Time, daddy!
For anybody wondering when exactly George Lucas began working on The Empire Strikes Back, according to the Wikipedia and contemporaneous reporting, George Lucas began outlining Empire Strikes Back in about August of 1977, and story conferences began in November of 77 after George Lucas hired Lee Brackett as a screenwriter. So as long as Hurley could get his script done and get off the island by August, he would be in good shape. This week's calm question, we're going to come back to Daniel. Where does Daniel's black Dharma jumpsuit rank among the variety of Dharma uniform colors? This is something we've been discussing over the weeks that we've been spending in Dharmaville. Joanna, this is mainly for you, but we can all answer.
Well, it's so funny because, like, until I just read that, you wrote that, I didn't know that it was black. I thought it was one of the dark blue ones, though I don't know that it would make sense that the scientists from Ann Arbor and the janitorial staff would wear right. the same color.
It's I'm pretty sure it's like, yeah, black, full on black.
No, I'm looking at a photo of it now. It's I can't argue with you. It does look black. And what's funny is in next week's episode, I mean, Dan's in next week's episode, so that's not a spoiler, right? I'm looking at that one because that one we see him at night in this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the next week's episode, we see him in full day and he's wearing like it's a gray jumpsuit.
Right. So it's like a completely different one.
I don't know what happened. But a bunch of people pointed out that the jumpsuit that he's wearing when he gets off the sub has the Swan logo on it. And they were like, if the Swan was supposed to be super under wraps, why is Dan wearing a Swan logo Dharma jumpsuit? Anyway, black is the best one so far. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, I think this would be my because the darker colors are better, right?
Yes, yes.
They're slimming.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
Yeah, what do you think, Dave? Goth jumpsuit?
Yeah, I'll take a black jumpsuit.
Yeah.
Rather than a white jumpsuit, if you're going to go monochrome, go the one that doesn't show dirt.
What would be your ideal? Because I feel like for Dave, this is like a purple. But like, what would be your ideal, like fun, bright colored Dharma jumpsuit?
Ooh, yeah, you nailed mine, Neil. Perfect.
I'd go red.
Red?
That's so funny. Having just watched all of Shadow and Bone, like the different like kind of magic people wear different like beautiful coats,
mm-hmm.
and these magic users called the Heart Renders wear these beautiful red coats. So that's like nice. What's on my mind.
I think I would want mine to be like a reflective, almost reflective silver or gold, something with a little sheen on it.
So fancy.
We would find your body in the pit real easily.
Oh, yeah. I would stick out in the pit for sure.
We are back at the tipping point of season 5. We get to take a little break for some more Dharma hijinks. But as I talked about a little bit or alluded to earlier in the email section, we are in Miles' episode, which is an episode we did not get on season 4 when we were doing our flashbacks to our freighter people. We got left out with Miles. We got left out with Daniel. And now it looks like they found a place to insert it outside of, you know, Miles's mysterious facial hair, which appears in this episode, despite him not having facial hair when we saw him, I think, when Baby Ben was kidnapped. So some magic facial hair, but otherwise a really nice episode that I don't know, focusing it on the Ghost Brothers, the two characters that are allowed to be audience surrogates, I think really not only lends like joy to the capability of watching these characters interact, but also they can do things like discuss how their ghost powers are different and both be very confident that the other person is doing it wrong. And we play that for fun. And that's kind of an example of Lost giving us, I think, an answer they want us to be good with for a little while. Like, hey, we acknowledge there are different types of ghost powers. And even the people who talk to the dead are kind of wary of this power existing in, like, another way. Hurley is like, oh, cool, you could talk to him. And Miles is like, hey, no, it's more like they're talking, and it's just, like, the last electricity that's trapped in their dead brain. And Hurley's like, well, I play chess with Mr. Echo. So there's a big difference. Joanna, of all the things that Miles and Hurley could have talked about, do you think ghost rules or the dad inserting Hurley as a middle point between Miles and his dad paid off better for you?
Better for me than what?
Ghost Bros talking about ghost rules, mm-hmm. or her matchmaker Hurley?
Oh God, it's like which flavor of chocolate do you like better, Joanna? They're both so delicious. I guess if I only get to have one, I think it's when you add dad to the mix, because I think it's funny. I did want to, this is really, I promise this is related to answer your question, which is like, I was thinking about Miles in this episode and how fun Miles is since he joined the cast and how basically Miles gets to do a lot of what early season Sawyer got to do, right? Mm-hmm. But Sawyer has evolved. And so you just sort of like hit the restart with with a new character you've imported to get to do that stuff. And then this, we got to see some Miles growth and depth in this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
Miles has been such like a fun, wisecracking character, and Ken Leung gets to like do some emotional work in this episode, and he's really good at it, really good at it. And so I think his, you know, his snarky Sawyer-ness bouncing off of Hurley's genial Hurley-ness, which we know, we already know is a winning combination, right? Hurley and Sawyer can't beat it. So Hurley and Miles, great combo. But then you add the like stiffness of Dr. Pierre Chang to it, and it's just amazing. Hurley in the backseat, just giving eyes and like trying to work his therapy magic. Ugh, so good. A huge smile on my face the whole time.
Neil, mm-hmm. Dr. Pierre Chang, person who has given us some of the only facts on the island via videotape, seems to be a little bit of a grump, and now we learn, has abandoned his wife and child in a way that the wife seems to think is pretty vindictive. It seems like Lost is really only going to give us bad dads. Does Pierre Chang have a chance at redeeming himself?
Well,
because he does read his storybook to Miles and seems to be attempting to be a good father.
Yeah, I mean, I love the usage of Pierre Chang here, because he is, especially for folks that were like deep in watching Lost obsessing, he is this sort of mythological character that like he's this iconic guy who just sort of randomly seems to be popping up every once in a while in Lost. So to flesh out his story is super fun. And I also love that in this episode we get, you know, we're being told by other characters why we shouldn't like this guy, right? We're being told by, Miles is told by his mother that like he basically abandoned them. Miles tells us constantly that he doesn't care about his father and doesn't want to know his father. But in the end, we get this like really sweet scene where we can see him with the baby. And it's like, maybe he's a good dad. Maybe he's misunderstood. And that's when Lost is really operating extremely well. When they can do an episode where we're being constantly told that this character was like a bad dude and he mistreated his family and kicked him out and abandoned them. But then at the end, it's like, now I care about this guy. Now I'm invested in finding out what happened with Dr. Chang to break up his family. And so I love it. I love the way that they weave him into this episode, because the episode is otherwise, it's a Miles story. It's Hurley helping Miles. But I like the way that they use the actual character of Pierre Chang. It's great.
I think also the way that Dr. Chang reacts to Hurley, which is like kind of grumpy, but also like kind of amused. And if a character likes Hurley, then I'm inclined to try to like them somehow. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he seems to be the guy who's in charge of the science part of Dharma, right? Like we've seen Horace is sort of the community guy, and Dr. Chang has a lot of power. So I love the interaction with Hurley where he's like, he doesn't know Hurley that well. He needs Hurley to keep some secrets now about this body. And he does it in a way that is like very fun, which is like, how do you feel about polar bear poop?
Yeah, polar bear poop.
That's really fun. Something I should say, like a couple of our listeners were like, I knew it. I knew that like he would be Miles' dad, like based on that like kind of lazy thing of like, two Asian characters on the island. They're related. I will say that basically every single person watching Lost had also figured this out. Like this was the least surprising twist of all time. People had really like figured out that Miles was probably Pierre Chang's kid. And that's why I love the reveal in this episode, because it's such a throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, yeah, that dude is my dad, and I figured out a while ago.
That's right. It happens like three quarters of the way through the episode.
Yeah, that's a Lost season five writer's room special for you when they're breaking this episode. They're like, what if we just assume that Miles already knew?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah.
And then I also like the way Neil framed it, where it's like, here's like, besides, you know, Jacob, supposedly, we keep being introduced to like people that like know things about the island, and like here Pierre Chang shows up in the flesh, but we've now made him a character that we're interested and curious about. He's not...
He's not just a source of information anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the best answer to a mystery? It's a human who may or may not be a bad dad.
You know? Yeah, I mean, he's definitely on bad dad watch still, even with that last scene where he's being very sweet with his family.
In terms of the flashback, though, it's definitely a bad dad flashback, but we get some Dean Norris. So let me ask you, Joanna, was this flashback a retread? I could elaborate a little bit more if that's too open-ended.
I mean, it's not the most illuminating flashback.
Yes.
But it kind of is, in that we find out that Miles has had his power since he was a kid. We find out a little bit, like, the lay of the land of how he feels about his dad and his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dean Norris thing is, like, not super essential, but kind of, because it shows us that, like, Miles can be a huckster. Because, like, when we met him for the first time in that, like, in his off-island introduction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he seemed like a bit of a...
Stealing
like,
money from an old lady.
He's a combination huckster and someone who actually has... You know, and so to see a bit more of that is fun, question mark? I don't know.
I mean, I think it works because the idea of roping a father into that, into him actually doing like a time travel thing, into Empire Strikes Back ending specifically, like all the dad stuff clicks for me. It's just if I were to try to isolate the flashback, what does it tell me? It tells me Miles talks to dead people, which I already knew. That he can't talk to cremated people, which I didn't know, but I also don't know if that's important. And that, you know, he didn't like his dad. He had a bad dad, which I could just guess because it's Lost. None of those things suggest don't do it. It just, there are some times where I'm like, we're back to Dean Norris. What is he going to do? He's going to tell him he lied about his son. And I think I think those two scenes work, A, because Dean Norris is good, and two, because of the last line of that, is just like as close as they're able to, Miles has ever gotten to like actually telling somebody how he feels out loud. All of Miles's character work so far has been based off Ken Young's reaction shots and sarcasm acting, which is sort of why, you know, when Miles, I need you, the look on his face provides the emotional climax to the entire episode.
Yeah, and you can see the thread that they're pulling with the Dean Norris scenes, where it's like they're really just building to that moment where Miles is like, you should have been there for your son. Like, it's the thing he would have told his father. And I think it works because they get to that moment, and because that moment happens right before he leaves for the island, a journey that he, as I mentioned, knows might give him more information about his father. So I think it's an important moment for Miles. You know, it's like sometimes flashbacks work because it might be the memory that person is, one of the memories that's going through Miles's head along the journey of this episode on the island. Like, this might be something that Miles would remember as being, you know, an important part of what Hurley's helping him to do, which is like work through the shit with his dad, you know?
Speaking of new characters, Neil, do you think Brom has a bad dad?
Brom. I bet Brom is a bad
dad. Listen.
Oh, has children. Neglecting children to abduct people in vans.
The way that Brom talks in this episode, I think he's got a bad sky daddy at the very least. Like, he's definitely believing in something that is going to get him in trouble.
So, can I say a fun fact about Dean Norris really quickly?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was reading Alan Sepinwall's recap. So this aired April 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in the second season of Breaking Bad, is where we are in history. Mm-hmm. And in Alan Sepinwall's recap, he goes, Nice to see Dean Norris from the amazing Breaking Bad in a more prominent mainstream show. Also nice, you know. And it's just like, it's fun to remember that Breaking Bad until it didn't have its
until
ratings
jump. Until
it got
jump. On Netflix, mm-hmm. it did
yeah,
nothing.
Yeah, until its ratings jump was after season three. So between season three and four is when it had its like Netflix ratings jump. And so like Breaking Bad was still like kind of this like critically beloved but little watched AMC
from
show.
From the indie darling Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Nice to see Dean Norris get some mainstream attention. The ratings leaps. I was just looking at the Breaking Bad ratings, and the leap is so insane. Mm-hmm. There's like a massive leap in season four, and then like a pretty massive leap in or like, and that stays pretty steady in the 5A, the first half of season five, the final season. But then it goes from a 2.9 million rating to a 5.9 in its final season.
Yeah.
Oof.
Insane. Okay, anyway, this has been your Breaking Bad interlude.
Well, while we're there in Breaking Bad interlude, I do want to loop back to a long-term connection where Neil was like, oh, we didn't have Twitter. When this episode aired, we totally did have
That's
Twitter.
True.
So I was trying to quick search if I had tweeted anything about this episode of Lost, and I apparently did not start tweeting about Lost until 2010. So unfortunately, I can't do any tweet alongs.
But we're getting to the point where I do. I mean, I don't think any of those tweets still exist because I think I've cleared them out. But we're definitely getting into the period where, like, yeah, like 2010 during season six, Twitter was really forming into, I mean, a better version than it is now. But you know, definitely.
I don't think I joined Twitter until after Lost was over.
Really?
Because I was kind of late.
That's something you can look up. I think my Twitter account is it's an old relationship, me and Twitter.
Yeah. Mine says March 2008.
February 2008.
How do I find this out?
Just go to your
you
profile.
You joined January 2011.
Oh, I did.
There you go.
Yeah.
That upsets me that you got there before I did. Okay. Yeah, January 2011. Dustin Rolls made me join.
Yeah,
thanks,
I did know what I was looking for. Before we move on, there's mm-hmm. a thing in the notes here. It says that recappers were catching on to the dad issue thing. And I feel like we were just there. Who was caught on to Bad Dad?
No, all of them. And it's so funny because I'm like, this is the domino for you guys. Like all the recappers are like, wow, there are a lot of bad dads. And like half the recaps are them just listing out all the bad dads. And I'm like, it took you until some like it hot. To figure out that the show is obsessed with
the show's
bad dads.
Almost over.
It's like really funny.
The first Jack episode, it should have been obvious. Like in season one.
Well, like the Jack episode and then the Kate episode and the Locke episode, they're all like in,
oh right.
In,
remember like, when Locke's dad pushes him out of a skyscraper window? That didn't tip him off, eh? Okay.
So yeah, they were just sort of like, and it's so funny because they all kind of felt like they were inventing the wheel that week. They were all like, wow, if you really think about it, and just like listed them all out. And I was like, you all did that at the same time.
I bet
five
even
seasons and it was so and 13 late. Episodes for you guys to realize that it's the Bad Dad show. It's the Bad Dad science fiction show.
I would be willing to bet that 2009 Damon Lindelof found that pretty funny.
Yeah, probably. It's just like, oh, look, they got it.
Wait, can I ask you guys a spoiler question?
Sure.
Yes.
If there was a fan, something for the fans, that came out in Wired magazine in May 2009, and this episode aired in April 2009, do I have to wait until a May 2009 episode to talk about it?
So here's the thing. I looked up this fact when we were debating saying who the statue was in the calm, and mm-hmm. then we just did. But I think this is how it initially was confirmed, so let's do it now.
Sure. Did we say who it was in the calm?
I believe we did.
Oh, I thought we didn't. I thought we were playing. Oh, maybe I did.
Yeah. I think we were trying to explain why the horse, Horace, Horace joke was funny, but then also that it was just a joke and sort of like stumbled into the Tahoet or... Anyway, tell the story, though. This is a good story of how crazy Lost fandom was in May 2009.
Okay, in May 2009, there was an issue of Wired magazine that J.J. Abrams guest edited.
Was it the one with the mystery box on the cover?
I
might have
possibly.
That one. in my house right now. So I'm going to look for it after we're done.
It included Lost-related puzzles on pages 104 and 105, consisting of two pages of one- and two-digit numbers. When the first page was decrypted using a visionaire cipher, it read Uslet, Tersba, Sikwurdsf, and Romand, or use letters backwards from end. Counting letters backwards from the end of a section of an article on time travel written by Thorne Plates for the August 2003 issue of Wired, in which the Casimir effect was referenced, yielded the solution to the second page. The four-toed statue is Tuaret. I don't know if I'm mispronouncing that. But anyway, the four-toed statue is the Egyptian god Tuaret, T-A-W-E-R-E-T. That is who the statue is of. Use letters backwards from the end. I mean, this is wild. This is a wild thing that happened.
I mean,
if you Google Wired May 2009 issue, the first thing that comes up is a post breaking down this puzzle for you and how you were supposed to solve it. Because it is, you know, this is like when ARGs and stuff were happening, that people were testing the internet hive mind with Joker images and
And also I think this
the cover does have a literal mystery box on
Honestly this is the one. This I might be conflating it with another Wired magazine, so I'm sure if I'm wrong we'll get an email about it and that'll be helpful, but I think this is where J.J. Abrams first told the story of the mystery box, like his personal mystery box,
his TED talk. I thought that was the source. Let's find out when that was.
Yeah, that's a good question.
After this.
But the interesting thing is, and the reason why I think we could say
2007.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so it was the TED Talk. It was the TED Talk. But this, I feel like this is the first time I remember, like, it came online for me.
Yeah, it's an iconic, like, looking at that cover of the magazine, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Right?
I have more statue facts.
Sure.
You guys want to know them.
Yeah, let's do it.
So the statue has four toes, right? That's like a big thing about it, right? And at one point, Damon and Carlton said something like, we wanted to have six toes, but the network said six toes were too weird. Make it four toes instead, because, like, at least, you know, four toes, like, you can explain that away with, like, that one of their toes got chopped off and they have four toes. Not like they have an extra toe.
That's Sawyer extra stepped toes. On a nail in the jungle and time traveled backwards.
And when they made a model of his foot, it only had four toes on it. So it just reminded me of some of our early season one conversations about how the network, like, needed a plausible explanation for all the weird stuff. Like, you need to have, like, a grounded explanation for everything. But
it's amazing that they were still trying to do that, like, five seasons into the show.
Well, when did the statue make its first appearance?
Well, I guess, that was season two? Because it's Saeed and Son and Jin.
Yeah. On the boat, yeah.
Yeah, so that's season two. So they were still, you know, being a little...
Sure. That makes sense.
...touchy about it. But the one of the designers of the statue foot later came out with a different story, which is that six toes, it was hard to register. Just looking at six toes, your brain doesn't immediately register that that's too many toes. But four toes look unusual.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I can see that, you know, where you just might, like, gloss over it and be like, oh yeah, it's a toad statue. But, like, if it's four toes, you're like, what?
Where are all of its toes?
Anyway.
Yeah, it's like in cartooning, there's really no reason to give any cartoon, if you're doing, like, squash and stretch, four fingers. Like, the ring finger is visually extraneous for what we recognize as hand.
Interesting.
You just need a pointer, you need a pinky, and you need a middle finger, and you need a thumb. But, like, that ring finger, it's kind of pointless.
That's interesting. So anyway, those are some statue facts. We'll have a little bit more statue talk, I think, if I recall correctly, in the storm. But
The important thing about bringing it up, bringing up here, is they don't say the name of the Egyptian god on the show. That's why we're having trouble, like, pronouncing it or whatever, and that's why I think we could bring it up here, because it's not like we spoiled anything.
No, if they were giving up a game,
that's the god, blankety blank.
if they were giving up the game and like a month later, then like, you know, who cares? It's fine. So there you go.
Right. But that's the only time we officially learn the name of the statue is in a Wired puzzle in an issue edited by J.J. Abrams. Lost.
Whose build is the co-creator of Lost. And I'm just sort of like, technically.
Technically the co-creator of Lost.
Co-author of the pilot of Lost, J.J. Abrams. Yeah.
Did not watch this episode about making a Star Wars. Or maybe did and thought everybody needed to be dads. J.J., listen. it doesn't need to happen that way.
Oh, no. Did Lost break if J.J.,
Palpatine,
which broke Star Wars?
Palpatine, bad granddaddy.
Yeah. It's Hurley would be rewriting an entirely different Star Wars if this was taking place at a different time.
Sure.
Sorry, J.J. Abrams. He'd probably be rewriting Attack of the Clones.
There was a can I mention a George Lucas Lost connection?
Do it.
There was this tweet that kind of went viral over the last week about a letter that George Lucas wrote to Damon and Carlton. And it's an old letter. They read it out during the finale celebration or whatever. So it's an old letter, but it just sort of, as these things do, went viral again this last weekend. So I'm going to read it really quickly. I don't think there's any spoilers in it. but it is about endings. Congratulations on pulling off an amazing show. Don't tell anyone, but when Star Wars first came out, I didn't know where it was going either. The trick is to pretend you plan the whole thing out in advance, throw in some father issues and reference to other stories, let's call them homages, and you've got a series. In 6 seasons, you've managed to span both time and space, and I don't think I'm alone in saying that I never saw what was around the corner. Now that it's all coming to an end, it's impressive to see how much has played out in advance and how neatly you've wrapped up everything. You've created something really special. I'm sad that the series is ending, but I look forward to seeing what you two are going to do next. So that's from George Lucas. I just thought it was apt to read it because this is the Star Wars episode of Lost. So there you go.
And then like he wrote that letter and sent it to Damon Carlton and then went into Disney and is like, here's my ideas for a sequel trilogy. And they're like, we're not going to use any of them, but we will take your toys.
And here's $4 billion.
Here's $4 billion. And then George Lucas is like, this is like white slavery. And now that's where we're stuck now in this weird thing. And are we a Star Wars podcast? We should be a Star Wars podcast.
Have I ever told you my favorite George Lucas story?
Yeah, no, let's do it. Now's the time.
I was at this, Vanity Fair does this summit event every year, which is sort of like a tech sort of kind of focused festival that we do out in California. It used to be up here in San Francisco. They moved it down to LA. But Melody Hobson, who is George Lucas's wife, is like one of our favorite moderators. She's incredible at her job. She's so good. And so she came to moderate a couple things. I forget who she was interviewing. And he just like attended as her plus one and just sat in the back in the green room and just like read a physical newspaper in the corner, just like low key George Lucas hanging out. And like J.J. Abrams was there, Mark Zuckerberg was there, and all these like people were there. J.J. Abrams was just like, I mean, and George Lucas is just like Mr. Melody Hobson in the corner reading his paper, not kind of talking to people, but not really. And it was just really funny. So
making the joke like I'm her ride, like, you know, like that kind of dude.
Yeah, it was great. I like him being married to Melody Hobson, who is so impressive and cool, is one of my favorite things about him. You know what I mean? I like, it's like why I like the Lonely Island guys so much, because all of their wives are really fucking cool.
All right, back to Lost. Wait, maybe not. Let's stick with the Star Wars. We got more Star Wars to talk about in this episode. I want Joanna to explain these notes right here, which seem to be making some parallels to this episode actually having Star Wars plot not involving fathers as some sort of parallel. Is the Swan the Death Star?
I mean, is the Swan the Death Star?
They're definitely building it.
It is not any moon.
I don't know. Like, well, I think the best comparison we can draw is, and this cropped up in a couple different recaps I read. They were trying to make connections between Star Wars and Lost. And like, I think the cleanest connection is to say that Miles contains both Luke and Han like qualities within him, which I like. Mm-hmm. A reductive thing to say about Hurley is that he is the Chewie, but like it's reductive, but it's also like everyone loves Chewie and everyone loves Hurley, so I'm not mad about it. Someone compared Sawyer to Lando trying to like run around Cloud City and like save
people. Deal keeps getting worse.
Yeah, exactly. Like trying to keep preserve his what's his while also not like getting people that he cares about killed at the same time, which I kind of liked. And then yeah, why wouldn't the Swan be the Death Star? Yeah, I kind of like that. What do you guys think?
I mean, I guess I get what you're going for there, because one of our Luke stand-ins character's father is like sort of overseeing the Swan as if like a Vader, but you also have like a Rosinski Tarkin, and you're gonna have to, but we aren't rescuing anybody from the Swan yet that no. I know of, which would be the major parallel, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that, you know, they're building this thing that ultimately like the Swan does or does not maybe like take down their plane, right? Like, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and they're building this thing that is gonna like cause massive destruction.
I guess Desmond could be the Princess Leia in that situation.
It's not a one-to-one comparison.
Yeah, I mean,
if you're saying, are our heroes going to have to storm a castle at the end of the season, that seems like something that maybe I could get behind.
I'm saying Nikki and Paolo are Ewoks and you can't convince me otherwise.
Yub nub.
This week on Exposé.
Yeah. While we're still talking about Star Wars, the official podcast check-in is going to jump in this week. There's not a transcript, but there were a lot of questions, one of which was a very angry listener, watcher, who wrote in to say, like, how dare you shit talk the Ewoks? Like, this, you know, race of cuddly teddy bears who stepped in to save your asses from the Empire. And they go on to a long tangent about the argument in the writer's room that they had to come up with. And basically, it's not that Hurley dislikes Ewoks. Hurley believes, this is the canonical answer for Lost, that if Empire was done correctly, the final battle in Return of the Jedi would have taken place on Kashyyyk with Wookiees as was intended, and wouldn't have queued it out to be Ewoks. So it's not that he hates Ewoks as a species. It's that he hates that the story had to go to Ewoks. So he is, in his mind, going to go with Empire and try to bend George Lucas back to a showdown on Kashyyyk with the Wookiees. I don't know how we feel about that.
I mean, I'm not against it. I'll say that much.
How Hurley canonically feels about it. Which, because it feels weird, right? Like, Hurley, I love a Star Wars reference, obviously, but also super Star Wars geeks, us three. So, does it seem a little weird to you guys that he's rewriting Empire Strikes Back and then goes on a tangent about Ewoks? Because it's not the same movie. Does it seem weird that Hurley has the events out of order of when, you know, Luke loses his hand and the father thing comes up?
Here's what I'll say. Jorge Garcia plays Hurley, is older than all of us. I think there's a real Ewok dividing line. We were kids when Ewoks came out, and we thought Ewoks were pretty chill. But like older
Star
Wars fans,
it's like
fans
the people younger than us and pod racing.
Yeah, they like the Phantom Menace. We like Ewoks, but like there are plenty of people who didn't like Ewoks. I one of my favorite lines from the TV show Spaced, right, is when Simon Pegg's character says, you know, Jar Jar Binks makes the Ewoks look like fucking shaft. Like that, you know, the Ewoks were kind of reviled for a while. These teddy bear, the whole thing. But we were kids and we loved it.
Yeah.
I know he's not rewriting Jedi. He's writing Empire, which is considered the most successful thing. But I think it also just makes sense in terms of like the timing. Like if they're in this year, like if the time works out for him to want
oh, absolutely.
To work on Empire,
and
right?
it's bad daddy. So someone come up with that idea in the room, and they're like, "Wait, if it's 77, you know what Hurley's thinking about?" And they're like, "Fucking Star Wars." They're like, "Oh my god, he's riding Empire and he does his dad thing. And someone's like, oh my God, we broke it. Like, I could see that happening.
And then they went home at 4 o'clock that day. They were so pleased with themselves. I should say that we accidentally, you may recall a couple weeks ago, organically thought of this as something that we might do if we went back in time. And then, like, if you re-listen that episode, you commies, you might hear all of us midway through that conversation realize we were talking about the plot of Some Like It Hot, and we're like,
Whoa, what if you rewrite a movie screw? What if you did? Neil's in New Zealand. Let's move on.
Oh, no. You know what I love about this? First of all, I'm not a big fan of, like, nitpicking every little thing. So if I was in Dharmaville and Hurley were giving me this information and he got some of the events wrong, or even if I knew it was true, Hurley's passion and his true, pure, sweet love of Star Wars makes it all okay. There's no reason to nitpick Hurley. Let's just love Hurley like he loves Star Wars, is what I'm saying.
I mean, and bear in mind, I mean, Miles might know better, but the actual Dharma Initiative, like, they aren't living in a culture where you obsessively rewatch something yet.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, unless it's Phil and security tapes.
You guys are so nice. I would have, like, gotten to page one of his notebook, and I'm like, it's called an Imperial Probe Droid. You call yourself a Star Wars fan? Good God. Like, you know, spelling mistakes, that's fine, but, like, it has a name. It's a probe droid.
And he would have
it's
been like, hey man, hot. I hooked you up with that purple jumpsuit. Be nice.
Yeah,
to
I would have been like, fair enough. Give me one of your sandwiches. Hurley's sandwiches. Really? Okay. Out of all the people in Dharmaville, Hurley's managed to bypass a lot of the strife, it appears.
Thriving.
He has a job that he seems to like. He has enough mental bandwidth to be caring about other people in Dharmaville, which maybe LaFleur does. Sawyer, I don't know. He's basically LaFleur in my mind now. Maybe LaFleur does, but he still has a priority of, you know, wanting to keep his secret, wanting to keep his relationship with Juliet, you know, wanting to hold on to his little piece of heaven he's made for himself on this island. Hurley's just like game. He's always trying to improve his situation and everybody's situation. And that's why we love him.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you think about the sort of roller coaster arc of Hurley's life up to this point, you know, he's had a tough upbringing and then he won the lottery and then that went terribly. And then he was in a plane crash. And then Hurley had, I think, you know, Jack had a pretty bad time off the island, among the Oceanic Six, but Hurley also, I think, had among the worst times. So what I love about it is that Hurley, not only is he like thriving and really just sort of enjoying being part of the Dharmaville community and having a job and just sort of chilling out, but we also get like a super healthy version of Hurley. And I think that that is extremely useful in him helping Miles. Like I wrote in the notes, like Hurley is the island's best therapist. Like by far, because right now the only other one we knew of was Harper. And
you put that bar on the right, floor for Hurley to right, stumble over.
Wet or dry, Hurley is much better than Harper.
Wet or dry, Hurley is your guy.
But I mean, we're seeing the result of Hurley's growth as a character. Like now that he is back on the island, it almost kind of doesn't matter what happens because at least he is not living this sort of like paranoid hell that he was living to the point where he was institutionalizing himself before they returned to the island, right? Like he was at Santa Rosa because he didn't want to go anywhere else. He didn't trust Oceanic. He barely knew if he could trust his friends. I'm really happy for Hurley. He seems to be doing really well.
Yeah, and what's also true is that in the context of the island, his thing with ghosts is not like the weirdest thing about the island, right? Like he feels pretty free to talk to Miles about it. Like you see ghosts, I talk to dead people too. Like it's fine. Like he's so at peace with it. Whereas you're right, like that fact alone caused him to lock himself away back in
yeah, Los he's Angeles. Probably so, enjoying his chess games with Mr. Echo a lot more.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Charlie's teaching him how to play that guitar he brought to the island. Just saying, there's
off
time. I
can't wait to see him bust out that guitar.
Do-do-do-do-do-do, just classical gas right off the beat. It's going to be fantastic.
He knows you all, everybody, from memory.
Ghost Bros.
That's what it could have been. After he finishes Star Wars, then he writes a Drive Shaft album.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be.
Oh,
it'll
I thought
be
you were going to say Ghostbusters.
Oh, and then he writes Ghostbusters. A little too on the nose, maybe.
Mm.
He's got to meet Zool in the Dharma Pit first or something. Give him that little spark of an idea. And besides, Neil's rewriting Caddyshack, so he might as well just let him roll on to Ghostbusters.
Sure.
Just, all right, Neil handle comedy.
Well, yeah, Neil saves the 80s comedy.
Hurley and I will both use young Bill Murray as our muse.
Yeah, that'll be great. All right, speaking of people who are attempting to play therapist in Dharmaville and not succeeding to the attempt that Hurley is, Kate kind of tips her hand by trying to comfort old Roger Workman.
What kind of con woman are you, Kate Austin?
I think she's definitely switched entirely from con woman to mother mode in terms of how we're supposed to view the character, because that's the only reason that makes some sort of sense to me. Because as we've sort of talked about on this podcast, it makes no sense for Kate to actually be flirting with Roger Workman. This has to be like, you know, for the children. And then
for
like
the children,
for the children, a genuinely misjudged moment where Kate was trying to make a horrible man feel better about the child she stole for very good reasons, but island magic reasons that Roger Workman is not willing to listen to. Contemporary reactions to this scene was focused entirely on the beer Roger opened having a pull tab, which would not have existed in 1977, leading Lost to officially state, as a joke, but it is now on the Lostopedia, that Dharma actually invented tabs on beer.
Oh.
So there you go.
You think the DeGroots commissioned that study? Right.
It might have been Daniel. We don't know what he was doing before he came back.
I bet he did.
Yeah.
Of an afternoon, Dan invented the
right.
He took
a little break contemplating the rules of time travel and the universe, and he's like, you know what? Tabs.
Whatever happened, happened. And then he looked at his notebook, and there was a drawing of a beer tab, and he's like, wait a minute. Anyway, so we have Kate sort of starts the domino tipping in the end of the Dharma ruse. They've abducted Ben, they've taken him to the others, and then Kate sort of gets Roger Workman's hackles up, and it gets worse when Roger runs into Jack after being drinking. Jack is erasing the volcano from the school chalkboard. It's been maybe days since we saw it in The Man Behind the Curtain? So a little bit of weird time stamping there, which also makes me wonder where Annie and Horace's original woman friend
where
are.
Where is Samantha Mathis? Horace, what have you done with the body of Samantha Mathis?
You have to be in the circle of trust to know the answer to that question, Joanna, and we're just not in it. But Jack manages to, I think, play the Roger Workman situation pretty well. Mm-hmm. If we're going to...
You know what? Sarah, who emailed us, Sarah, whose last name might be Shepherd, I like Jack in this scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's Sarah Shepherd, that would explain the email a lot.
I think
that's what I'm saying.
I think the use of Jack here is interesting. Like, narratively, it's really... Like, Jack is the most equipped character to deal with a drunk father, but also this is like
drunken rage monster,
right? Yeah. But also it's Jack, it's sort of revisiting his trauma in real time. Mm-hmm. But I think it also it's a thing that it shows a little bit of growth in Jack, because you know how Jack chooses to fix the situation is he kind of does what Sawyer would want him to do, which is not what Jack normally does, which is, you know, try to divert Roger away and, you know, show him a little bit of like strength, right? And I think it works really well. I mean, it's Jack doing something nice for the group, you know, the group being the people who are trying to keep the secret. about the fact that they're not Dharma people.
I really see Jack trying in this scene.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
So. Yes. And then he immediately goes and lets everybody know, which means that I'm in favor of it because he's not doing the thing I hate about television, which is withholding information. You should just tell everybody. Jack's just like, all right, we're all on alert now. And strangely, like, it's Sawyer who takes the action that I would assume Jack would take. Like, if the situation is going to break, Jack's going to be the person that punches somebody. That's just what I expect from his character up until this point. And it's not. It's Sawyer who just, you know, finally breaks with poor little Phil.
Yeah. Well, and I think by that point, it's clear to Sawyer. I mean, Juliet obviously has expressed that, you know, her to Kate. I think it's our Axe Break Award winner. Is it? Is there an Axe Break
Award
winner?
It is.
Yes. All right, let's do that now. Because Juliet saying, you know, here we go, is her acknowledging that this is about to get really messy. The secret's about to come out, and we're going to have to sort of navigate our way through it. And I think by the end of this episode, after that conversation with Jack, Sawyer also understands that, especially when Dharma Phil shows up and sticks his nose in it. And, you know, good for Sawyer, because I bet that felt good, getting to punch Phil. Like, that guy, he's been working with him for 3 years.
I really love Dave's running theory that Phil just has, like, an enormous crush on LaFleur. And, like, mm-hmm. his anger here is that, like, Jim was keeping secrets from him.
Keeping secrets from him. He covered for him. He just was like, I need you to tell me what's happening so I know how to support
you
better.
He wants to be in Sawyer, or in LaFleur's circle of trust.
Yes. Yeah, if that's what we're calling it. Absolutely, he wants inside that circle. You never go with a LaFleur to a second location, but that's what Phil did, and he got clocked out for it. That's not what you say. Clocked out? That's not the word.
He got knocked out
by
being
clocked. He got his clock cleaned.
He got his clock cleaned.
Yeah.
And now he's going to be tied up next week, we're guessing.
I really love Juliet sort of gently exasperated. Well, okay. Face.
Like, Juliet, here we go. Keeping it together. Juliet and Jack calmly being like, deep breath.
Yeah. All right.
We tried not to do this, but then our, you know, significant others who are probably in love with each other ran off and took the baby Ben to the magic people. And
No. Juliet sent Sawyer out there.
Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Fair.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we are seeing this group, like I said, our group of people working together to, you know, communally sort of protect themselves from the secret getting out to the Dharma Initiative. And it really is, it's very different than what they were their first time on the island, right? Like, it's very different than the, you know, constant battling over leadership, the constant everyone has their own interest and is going their own direction. It is the first time that we've seen our, well, maybe not the first time, but, you know, it's a really good example of our group of survivors, like, working together and showing that they've been together for a while, like intuiting what they should be doing.
This is where I'm inclined to give Jack some credit, where it's like, is he doing it perfectly? No. But is he like deferring to Sawyer's leadership? Mm-hmm. Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, it doesn't sit very comfortably with him, but he's doing it.
He heard the Churchill Growth. Speech. He's trying to keep his ears and mind open.
Growth.
All right, a couple of more Miles things we're gonna pick up before we end with the time daddy. How did Miles get his powers? This is something that sort of are we asking for an origin? Do we think that he's like one of the Magic Island babies?
Well, someone suggested that the moment that Miles saw baby Miles is the moment that baby Miles got his powers.
Yeah.
Go.
There's some sort of like space-time conundrum triggered there.
It feels very intentional that his mom had, you know, passes away from cancer.
Mm.
And
so will they be exposed to something?
Yeah, so the question is like, will they be exposed to something? Did the fact that Miles lived on the island at one point in his life give him these powers, you know? Mm-hmm. So all very good questions indeed.
But it's fun to the conversation between Miles and Hurley, where they have different ways in which they speak to dead people.
Mm-hmm.
is a good reminder for me to sometimes unclench around some of these like rules that I'm constantly trying to nail down. You know what I mean? Like when I'm like, why can Ben see his mom like on the island when she didn't die on the island? You know, and like the truth is there are some people, I mean, we've talked about this before, probably more in the storm than here, but like that there are some people who are like, quote unquote, force sensitive, but their force sensitivity manifests in different ways, like the X-Men, right? And so like if I and obviously I'm made to think about the X-Men because Ken Leung was in X-Men looking spiky as he does as a teen in this episode. But the idea that like Hurley and Miles are like basically similar X-Men but slightly different, you know, is a nice way to not think about them being like the rules being different for them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, and it's
they're a dichotomy of each other where Miles is the man of talking to dead people because of science and Hurley is the man of talking to dead people because of faith.
Ooh.
Ghostbuster of science, Ghostbuster of faith.
I mean, I also
one black.
I think it's just sort of a clever trick that the show is doing because, you know, this, as they got toward the end of the show, the pressure on them to like answer every little thing, you almost feel like this is a reaction to that where it's like, yeah, but what if we just make the waters a little muddier? Like, what if instead of having to provide every answer, we make, you know, we just sort of muddy the rules so then you stop worrying about it. So I like this. I'm sure there will be examples in between now and the end of things that they do that seem intentional like that, that we don't like, but I do like this one. I like varying the talking to dead people.
So we should keep an eye out for intentionally muddy waters. Is
sure.
What you're saying.
Yeah. Like sort of as a pushback to the people who were like, we need every single thing explained. Like, you know, the people who worked at the network.
Damn that network. All right. Let's see. Oh, we learned some new information about Charlie Widmore because Naomi gives Miles an audition of sorts, and the poor gentleman that Miles reads has died because he has obtained document proof that Charles Widmore has planted the fake flight and all the bodies in the ocean to keep people from looking at the island. And we see that file show up on the freighter in season 4, I believe. I don't think we've seen that dead gentleman before, but we have Naomi returning. Hi, Naomi. As apparently an agent of Widmore, at least that's where she has been presented as previously, with seeing some Abaddon interactions in season 4. But we also have another agent and the only character returning from last week's episode, Bram, who is working for his idea of the winning team. But we have no idea who that is. It just seems to be in opposition to the freighter. So options, at least if I hear opposition of the freighter, I think Ben. Mm-hmm. But, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense that Ben would have tried to cut off people at the freighter before the freighter came. He seemed to be pretty being punched in the face by Jack around that time and maybe preoccupied.
Like, if Alana and we decided it's Brahm, right?
Brahm.
I'm remembering it like the sound Brahm on the Inception soundtrack, right?
Hans Zimmer's favorite sound.
Brahm. Alana and Brahm, like, if they were working for Ben, wouldn't they, like, have recognized Ben?
Yeah, that's the little
so
twist
I,
there.
I gotta say third party, man.
A new player is entering the field.
They're not working for Charles, and they're not working for Benjamin.
And whoever they are, it's very, like, the way that Brahm is talking about it, it very much establishes, like, there's something, like, cultish about it. Like, his brushing off of Miles' desire to have, like, the money. He's like, we don't have money. We don't need money. We just have truth. And it's like, oh, okay. All right, bud. Whoever you work for is, you know, like, some cult leader or something. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. definitely some zealot eyes on that Brom in those.
Zealot eyes.
Yeah.
All right. And then the episode ends after a very touching moment where Miles thinks that his father needs him. And
wait. Before we get to Time Daddy, can I say one last Miles thing?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So this idea of like, can you, whatever happened, right? Speaking of Time Daddy, right? which is all I'm calling him from now on. Okay. So like, that's the whole thing. It's like, you can't change the past, right? But, like, what I think is really cool about what Hurley is trying to do here for Miles is, like, okay, you can't change your childhood relationship with your father. But in this cool island magic way, it's not too late for you to have a relationship with your father.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, he is able to rewrite history, kind of. He's not going to change what his childhood was, but for many people who had, you know, a bad... like or an absentee parent or a bad parent or whatever, like you can hold that resentment or you can whatever, but a lot of people would give anything to be able to try to have that relationship, and because of time travel Miles can. So it's kind of rewriting history in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean it's I think Hurley is very simply just encouraging him to like live in the moment of where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think, you know, we've discussed the way the universe and time travel work on Lost. I think no matter what Miles tries to do here, unless, and this is still an open question for me, unless him like hold as Hurley's just like holding his own baby self would cause the whole universe to explode. which is possible. Like, I think that they're, especially these two characters should be confident enough in their knowledge of the time travel rules at this point to be like, nothing we do is going to like change. Nothing we do can change like what happened to Miles previously. Like they can't like figure out a way for Miles's dad to like stay in his life. So whatever happened will ultimately happen. But if you live in the moment for a little while, might find a little happiness, is Hurley's point.
Right, and I think that's a question we need to hold on to for the rest of this season at least,
mm-hmm.
if not the rest of the show, is this idea of like, and we've talked about it a little bit before, but this idea of like, can you learn to accept that what happened? Because that's the only way to move forward,
mm-hmm.
is if you don't try to change or deny or suppress what happened, accept it and grow from it.
Yeah. Sorry. Again, Hurley, best therapist on the island. Eat shit, Harper. Is on.
Oh my god. Just and like, has there ever been a more universally beloved character than Hurley?
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
It's hard to say.
Everyone loves him.
Yep.
Every time he shows up, you're just so happy.
Yep.
So
he could even give me a sandwich that has spoiled mustard and give me food poisoning, and I would still immediately forgive him.
That's true.
We're going to skip directly to a corner. It's a woo-loo-loo, the best time travel moment, where Time Daddy shows up at the end of the episode. Because, you know, when Dan Faraday shows up, things are going to get serious.
Or at least we're going to learn some new time travel rules.
Time Daddy!
Time Daddy!
Oh, Dan.
All right, let's keep rolling with the corners. Neil, we have a Giacchino corner this week.
We do. There is a track from season 5. This is the music that plays over the scene when young Miles is hearing the person who died in their apartment. And it is called I Hear Dead People, which not the most original thing because The Sixth Sense had been out for quite a while at this point, right? When did The Sixth Sense come out?
99?
Yeah. So Giacchino, not the most original thing, but still very fun and very appropriate.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, do you have a Giacchino comment?
No, I just wanted to say a Time Daddy thing really quickly before we move on, which is that, I don't know, I just want to keep us to think about the way in which Dan Faraday is utilized this season and, like, the decision to keep him away for a couple episodes, the decision to keep his whereabouts a bit of like a mystery. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know. It's interesting. We'll talk about it more next week, but it's just,
yeah, I wonder, interesting to me. And this would be a question for our Calm listeners, who can email us, hosts@stormpodcast.com, and tell us all about it. Is, you know, where did you think Dan, what did you ever at any point think like, oh, did Dan die? Or, you know, did you have any fun theories? Cause he really is, they don't talk about him at all until he kind of just comes.
They talk about him ominously. Right. Sawyer's like, he used to be here. Right. And you're like, where'd Dan go?
Yeah. So, like, I mean, I remember this the first time around being a huge surprise. I mean, mostly cause it's the end of an episode and Lost is very good at that. But also because it really was like, legitimately could have gone either way on old Dan Faraday. So that's interesting.
It really does seem like a your kids, Marty. Something's gotta be done about your kids moment.
Our jungle of mystery moment goes to the numbers being the serial number and getting chinked into the hatch there with were the numbers always just a serial number? Is this a magical island moment? Is it just that Hurley was having too good of a time and some Sky Dad was like, feel bad now? And that Sky Dad's name was Dave? Maybe. We'll find out. Let's look into it. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Alvarez. What? Who was Alvarez? He was a gentleman who was thinking about a girl he liked back on the mainland when his filling was sucked through the back of his head by some sort of magic magnetic force.
What a terrible way to go.
It is. It's a pretty way to go. And then apparently fell into a ditch. But that's going to bring us to Ben's talking. So it's obviously a lie award. Dude, can't go to Ben this episode. Ben's not in this episode. Goes to Rosinski. He said he fell into a ditch about poor Alvarez, who has a hole in his head.
Yeah,
and Miles so, notices. And
yeah,
thinks
it's so obviously a lie that Miles calls him out immediately.
Yeah, just be like, oh, the ditch have a gun. And the funny thing also, is the ditch
isn't Rosinski rude to Hurley in this episode?
I mean,
does
Rosinski assume he is?
You'd be the better question is like, is there a moment where Rosinski is not being rude ever in the show?
Look, and Pierre I think the answer Chang is no. Pierre Chang wasn't on the council with all the other Dharma assholes who voted to execute Saeed, so he's the only morally defensible one. So that's, far. That's Phil fair. Also just doing it for love. So Phil and...
Even what's her name with the brownies? Goddamn.
Yeah, she was there. She voted kill Saeed. So I'm just saying, Phil, you know, Phil's... I feel sad for Phil, but Pierre Chang is the only one who could maybe be redemptive yet because he didn't want to kill Saeed. Didn't want to just execute a dude. Anyway. The I Married Her coincidence corner. Surprise, Pierre Chang is Miles' dad. You all figured it out, but it happens. In this episode. What a coincidence. What amazing... Actually, now that our headcanon is that he probably knew that anyway, and he was going to the island, and he's like, best case scenario, you know, I talk to some dead people and lead them to Ben Linus and get $1.6 million. Worst case scenario, I talk to one of those people, and this place is the secret place my mom told me I could never go to and talk to my dad.
Okay, this reminds me of my theory of why Miles ultimately went to the island, which is... Like, he specifically, you know, asks, where is my father's body to the mother? And she's like, somewhere you can never go. But I think Miles was going to the island to talk to his father's dead body.
I mean, yeah,
to see if he could at least, like, find his grave and, you know, read him. Because Miles isn't having a conversation like we previously thought he was. The way he explains this, he's, like, reading the book of someone's life, you know? So... Mm-hmm. I think
the last chapter at least.
Yeah, so I think he went there to find out what really happened.
If his dad was thinking about him when he died.
Sure. Yeah.
That's really sad.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's it makes the whole end of this episode even sadder.
Man, it does make it sadder, but now I'm like, didn't Miles walk past the ditch of all the Dharma people?
We don't know if Pierre Chang was in there though.
We actually don't even know if Pierre Chang is dead, right?
Yeah, I guess
that's true. We don't.
Yeah, we don't.
We just had to take Miles' mom's word for it.
Well, and I mean, I guess it's kind of safe to assume, or you can see how Miles would assume that he's at least on the island somewhere.
Yeah. Guess I'm out of the book club. I get to do this week. Me and My Polar Bear, which is the book that Pierre Chang's reading to Baby Miles, and that book does not exist. Props made it up, but of course they'd have polar bear themed books. And you know, he could probably, Pierre Chang could take his little Miles and go visit the polar bears on high tide.
Do you think there's a section of that book that's about cleaning up after your polar bear and polar bear poop?
Oh, probably.
Like,
yeah,
that's why Pierre Chang
bear.
Had polar bear poop on the mind.
Feces.
That means it's time for the Jungle of Kistery moment. That's where every week we decide who needs to be kissing on Lost. How did we do last week, Joanna, for Dead is Dead?
Last week was a Ben episode, so we got a lot of Ben here, and Ben is not usually popular in the Kistery poll unless under one very specific circumstance. So Ben and fear, like Ben and actually being afraid, only got 11% of the vote for our Kistery poll, which you can vote over on twitter.com/stormpodcast. Ben and John, our intellectual brethren, only got 11.6% of the vote. Sun and Lapidus, 23.2% of the vote. A couple people are willing to entertain our idea that maybe those two were doing something else while they were waiting in Dharmaville, but running away easily with the whole thing. It's Ben's face and Desmond's fist. A freshly milked Desmond pummeled the shit out of Ben's face, and then Stephen Williams directed a beautiful shot of that blood pouring out of his face. 54.3% of the vote. This week is a Miles episode, so I'm like it hot. So we've got a few options here. We've got Miles and Baby Miles. That comes from Neil.
Yeah, this is my. I want to see him test the theory of whether the universe would implode if he kissed his own baby self.
There we go. Dave's running theory of Phil and Jim, Dharma lovers, Phil and Jim. Phil is acting like a jilted lover. There we go. My entry is Miles and his fish tacos. Damn you, Brum. Yeah.
Brum had neither $3.2 million or however much those tacos cost.
Ridiculous.
Terrible.
But last but not least, this comes from a couple of our listeners, including Dre and Eastern Violet. They suggested, of course, the Alterna roommates, Miles and Hurley.
The original
New Sawyer
Ghostbusters.
And Hurley. There you go. So those are your options. You can vote this week on twitter.com/stormpodcast for our weekly Kistery poll.
All right. The most 1977 thing, security tapes, magnetic footage on a tape. And that's how we run security around here. Imagine such a thing. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Awards goes to the poor man in the apartment who, according to Miles, died calling out for his wife Kimberly. We're gonna give it to him, Kimberly.
Aww.
yeah
poor sad stuff,
poor Kimberly. And with that, we've got all the corners, so that means it's time for the storm right after this.
All right, now is time on the podcast where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. These are the folks that get everything. They get our weekly, like, 4, sometimes 3 extra podcasts a week, honestly. So they include some newcomers: Justin Moy, Nicole Guerra, Catherine Laronde, Alan Harlan, Michael Amon, Brian Nelson, Percival Buenaventura, Darian J. Taylor, Tony Perez, Jason Allen, Jack Sinclair, Jen Davis, Ole Bauman, Ramses Severiano, Catherine Altmeyer, Bryce Pools, Lauren Hunter, Laura Fairbanks, Sam, and Danielle Wilkinson. Thank you so much. Halfway through those names, I realized I didn't have my glasses on, so I apologize.
And I would like to add to those thanks Angela Susan Sadness, Diana Fisher, Sam Williams, Dila Vach, Beth Weingartner, Mike Harris, Matthew Wilson, Grayson Owen, Guava Corvallis, Emily Ann, Lauren Adams, Heather Carpenter, Caleb McKee, Aaron Shelley, Christy Rice, Jillian Walsh, Catherine, Stephanie Berman, Sarah Trites, and Aaron Gowork. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Paula Silva, Nate, Allison Heishman, Andrew Bird, Helsey Lee Measure, Alex, Matt Polari, Peter Hobson, Lisa Romney, Lawrence Medina, Serafina Cobain, Justin Way, Aubrey, Lorenzo Ciandra, Amy Schreiner-Thomas, Scott McNeil, Monica Wolf, Jesse Baird, Fainting Violet, Andrea Rodriguez Garcia. Thank you all so very much for being members of the Small Council.
Welcome back to the storm, everybody. This week, we are going to continue to have high energy, as we do every week, but we're going to continue our countdown to the end of the series here in the storm. I feel weird about leading into that now because I think we're still... Have we added a day? Are we closer to...
We're still on day three.
We're still on day three. Okay. So we're still...
That's the thing. There's only like 14 days after the Ajira landing in universe time, but they really stretch it out.
Interesting.
The better to wear the same shirt all the way through.
is he wearing old blue under that jumpsuit? Probably, because he's Jack Shepard.
Old blue.
All right, we have emails and mm-hmm. we have thoughts. What order do we want to take these in? I like the Joanna run the storm we had last week. That seems like we were going in a good direction with that.
Pew pew pew! Let's do it. All right, welcome to the storm. High energy time.
Oh god damn it! You're gonna outdo me just like right at the drop of a hat. If you bring back pew pew pew, they're just gonna make you do it every week.
So I wanted to start by talking again about Star Wars.
I am here once again.
It's easy
to talk
about the Swan as the Death Star in the storm, right?
Yeah.
The Swan is the Death Star is like, we need to...
And Juliet is the hero.
Fire this explosive down one specific shaft mm-hmm. in order to blow the whole thing up mm-hmm. sort of thing. That's their mission.
And
right?
then Kate pushes Juliet down the shaft like Luke Skywalker.
Killer Kate. No, the Boba Fett gets eaten by the Sarlacc. Juliet gets eaten by the Swan Station.
It's true.
And then I don't know who I think the Ewoks are the temple.
Oh, yeah. The Ewoks are, I'm trying to think of.
Where you just sort of like, oh,
I mean, it's Brahm and what's her name and Brahm. The cult of Jacob, right?
Those are the Ewoks? Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, so anyway, I just wanted to stretch that Star Wars metaphor a little further. I also want to read this part from, I think it was Emily Vandervoof's recap, where she was going off about this Egyptian thing. She wrote, apparently there were Egyptian this is, once again, a contemporaneous recap. A recap that was written at the time. Apparently there were Egyptian hieroglyphs on the board that Jack was cleaning off. I'm getting a little tired of online Lost fans assuming that the entire solution to Lost lays within Egyptian mythology and that Richard Alpert will stand up and proclaim, I am the great sun god Ra in the finale, and it will all make sense. Lost just likes to reference major points in Western Civ. That doesn't mean that it's going to suddenly try to give us likely impossible crash course in Egyptian mythology. Okay, so while it does not give us a crash course in Egyptian mythology, I think Emily is a little further from the point than the fans that she's sort of exhausted by. What do you guys think?
Yes, only because if Richard was Ra, that would be great. Like, that doesn't make...
That would be great.
That theory is good enough to make me not, you know, to be okay with maybe being Abiturno being something else. But yes. It's like I don't know how much this is post internet or post monoculture sort of like dying out, or like when we weren't all watching like Johnny Carson or whatever the pre like broadcast thing was. But it would almost seem like, maybe it's also because I've aged up in the age of like the rise of the geek and the sci-fi stories. There was a time, and it might be around when this was airing, where I would think like stopping to do an episode that's like a crash course on Egyptian mythology could have maybe been okay. And really, like, would an Egyptian flashback episode have been better than Across the Sea? That might be just be a wash in my mind even still, you know? Like, I like the type of science fiction that is like, you remember this thing that we can't explain about, like, ancient cultures? Well, let's explain it. You know, absolutely start Alien versus Predators with the Predators built the pyramids. I'm into that. I'm going to give you that leeway. I don't know if Lost has ever been that type of show where it's connecting to the real world like that. It's building its own mythology. You know, it's giving us Dharma. It's giving us the Widmore Corporation. It's not Chase Bank and a whole bunch of hippies that were, you know, fresh off of the summer of 69 that have like names. So I feel like almost connecting it back to like, it's like the books. It's like the books, right, Joanna? They're putting books in. And it's not that the books aren't related to the plot of the show, but the books aren't going to give away the plot of the show by like telling you that there's a book about, you know, a shadow guy.
Right, Joanna?
Right, Joanna?
I mean, I think all of this would feel a little bit more coherent, cohesive, if, no offense to Titus Welliver and Mark Pellegrino, but if they had not hired white guys to play these, like, ancient deities. And, you know, and what's even wilder is that, you know, my memory is that the woman who, like, crashes on the island in Across the Sea is not white. So I don't know how she popped out these white babies. Allison Janney is certainly white. But like, I don't know. That's just always been a little, well, I will say in recent rewatches, that's been weird to me, where we have like so much ancient Egyptian iconography, so much like ancient cultural sort of mysticism around these people, and they're so white. Why? So I don't know.
I also think, that this is sort of prophetic advice from Emily back in the day, which is like that there was one of the things that a lot of like the, you know, very detail oriented fans of Lost weren't happy about was that we don't get enough answers about the mythology of, about like the long history of the island. I think. And some of this is sort of where people started to get really like wrapped around the axle about, you know, the every little detail of Lost. Because Dave's right. It is kind of like the books where it's like, you're not going to be able, if you read all the books that Sawyer reads, you're not going to learn any spoilers necessarily about where Lost is going. The hieroglyphs are the same thing. And I think this is sort of what leads them down to the path to what Joanna's talking about, which is like, they just sort of sprinkle it in there. So it doesn't seem super serious to the writer's room. And that's where they make some mistakes, right? And that's where like they get themselves into some troublesome places, like casting
people
two
like,
white
dudes.
What
about the Hurley Bird? And they're like, we thought that was just mysterious.
Sure. Yeah. So, and I think, you know, and we talked earlier in the episode about how there are things where instead of explaining, they decide to like muddy it just a little bit more. To not directly signal, but to sort of like push the audience away from getting too wrapped up in every single image that you see. You know, of course, they also spent a lot of time in the previous almost five full seasons making us want to care about the details. So, you know, they sort of dug that one themselves.
This week's we are talking about Some Like It Hoth was when Neil started talking about muddy water, and I'm like, I need to lampshade this right now. Keep an eye out for some muddy water in the future, guys. Right? Maybe that's something that we're seeing.
Are they? Is that a metaphor or is that literally just?
Oh, this is Saeed muddy water. We are gonna see some shit.
But you know, I mean,
oh my god, thinking of things we're gonna see. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
But yeah, some of it is the show, the writers' room reacting to the way people reacted to the show. You know, I mean, that's always going to be true about Game of Thrones, no matter what the creators say, and it's always going to be true about Lost.
So we got this email from Matthew. This is directly related to what we're talking about. Matthew writes, last week, Joanna suggested that the statue is already on the island during Across the Sea. However, we don't see the statue in that episode. Although, as usual in Lost, the chronology isn't totally clear, I tend to think that the Egyptians arrive later than Across the Sea, forming a kind of cult around Jacob and Smokey, treating them as gods. In Dead is Dead, we saw artwork under the Temple of Smokey and Anubis. The man in black creates the donkey wheel, but it seems to be the Egyptians who install it in the chamber under the orchid. The Egyptians seem to have had their own version of the incident and installed the cork later than Across the Sea.
That's a fun one.
I guess so. It's just such like a weird, I mean, not the email's great, but like, it's just such like a weird thing to be like, yada, 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 Egyptians here, we're here at some point, but we're never going to show them or talk about it? Question mark.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, like that if you're paying such close attention to all of the details, like hieroglyphs, then you're never, they're never going to pay that off. So I don't know. I think Emily might've been right at the time. Don't obsess over that too much.
And also, doesn't that make the whole question of the smoke monster talking to the Tauret or whatever that was in last week's episode super complicated? Because what you're saying is the Egyptians had a whole incident before the smoke monster was created, right?
After
the smoke monster is created, they had an incident.
Right, because the cave with the golden light doesn't have the cork in it when the man in black is thrown into it.
That's an assumption you can make, I think, yeah. I mean, it glows, but then...
Write us your cork thoughts.
Yeah.
Go to stormpodcast.com.
Fire up those cork theories. It's almost
we
time.
Did it.
Love a cork.
Hey,
love
we
cork
got it. We're in the back half of season 5. It's time for the cork thoughts. It's been a long time coming. Thoughts.
Remember you referenced the like whatever equation in the first episode of the storm? The
Vinzetti equation. Well, because there's no other good place to bring that up. Like, this is the fucking answer about the numbers. Like, this is the on-show answer about the numbers. It's a fucking serial number. Like, it frustrates me. Like, there's obviously a little bit more that's magical about it, but if you're looking for an answer in the show, and like the earliest time the numbers show up, here it is. We just saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And so, does the fact that Hurley witnessed the numbers going on to the door, similar to the way Miles gives himself the ability to talk to ghosts, does it sort of mark Hurley on the time-space continuum?
Maybe. That's, like, does he make himself a candidate by, like, manifesting
the numbers?
Well,
we'll know for certain if he goes up and gives the serial number
right,
like,
yeah, if he,
a little kiss.
If he were to go up and kiss that hatch, which we all want to, the entire world
kiss.
Would explode.
That
on Lossopedia, they're like, well, you know, there's one worker who, you know, lifts this hatch, and like when we saw like Jack and John try to lift it, it took like both of them like a lot of strength, and it was like supposed to be like a foot thick thing, you know, hatch. And I'm like, guys, that entire thing, like a nuclear bomb's about to go off over it. Like, that is not the hatch that they open.
Sure.
Like, they're going to reprint that hatch with thicker things that is meant to cover this concrete nuke bomb incident.
Also,
like, it's fine.
It looks like they're imprinting the numbers in this episode on the actual hatch itself. But when Hurley sees the numbers on the hatch in season 1, it's on like the concrete outer shell of the hatch.
Yeah.
So this is not the exact same serial number that Hurley sees later.
Yeah, not an error. Just remember that it all gets blown up.
Yeah, Juliet Luke Skywalker's it here at the end of the season.
Well, she's pretty used to blasting womp rats back in outside of Portland. Okay, this email comes from Kyle, and it's in response to the discussion we had about Beth's email last week about we are the cause of our own suffering. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the email is titled, "We Are the Cause of Our Own Suffering is Not Originally a Tool of White Patriarchy." Hey guys, I wanted to weigh in on an email suggesting that we are the cause of our own suffering in the show reflects a white male view of the world. I'm not sure it does. I think the idea comes from both Buddhism and Hinduism, and given the concept of Dharma is a Hindu concept, I imagine the show is referencing these fundamentally Eastern concepts. I'm not an expert in Buddhism or Hindu spirituality, but I don't think that the idea above is that people cause the bad events in their lives. Rather, it's that there is a distinction between the events in our lives and our thoughts and feelings on those events. And our suffering from those events is a matter of having the wrong perspective on the events. For example, if a loved one of mine dies, I can choose to be sad that I've lost someone I care for and suffer, or I can take the perspective that I am joyous for the person who passed into some better, more peaceful afterlife. If my father thought I didn't have what it takes to be a great doctor, I can suffer by leaning into my resentment of him, or I can have gratitude for the motivation his doubt gave me to become a doctor. If my father killed my mother and himself because she slept with a con artist, classic scenario, I can suffer by hating him for the rest of my life, or I can be at peace by finding some way to let go of the resentment and give myself some credit for having survived into adulthood after a traumatic childhood, etc. Many of the castaways suffer on the island not because they caused the bad events in their past, they didn't, usually their parents did, but because they can't let go of the past or find some way to heal from it. I don't think telling marginalized groups to have a better attitude about their oppression is very helpful, of course. And you're the cause of your own suffering absolutely is an idea in our politics that has been weaponized against oppressed groups in America. But the show itself doesn't really direct it at any marginalized character, so I don't think the show is guilty of the behavior referenced in the email, Kyle. What do you think? Maybe starting with Dave.
I think there's a difference between we are the cause of our own suffering and life is suffering, which is the Eastern philosophy that he's referring to there. We are the cause of our own suffering assumes an agency that I don't think Eastern philosophies and religions want you to latch on to. It's not about becoming, you know, even really caring about the material plane. It's about moving forward. He's absolutely right in describing the way that that's about like a mindset and a perspective. But if we're talking about we are the cause of our own suffering as like how it's used in Lost, both as like sort of a thesis that it bats around very literally with the time travel stuff, but also as a method of brainwashing control, a phrase that we see in Room 23. Along with like Jacob loves you or whatnot. I think it's the use of it in the show is the white male perspective of it, even still to me. I think it's a great email from Kyle, but given what we talked about last time and what Lost is about, I do think there is a danger in thinking that humans have that much control over perspective, especially in a show that's going to introduce a, you know, bad god.
Becca, Neil, do you have anything to say?
Not really. I like that this is going to be, this is an ongoing discussion. I feel like every email we get has illuminated it in, it has illuminated the topic in some way for me, and I appreciate our listeners for writing in.
I was trying to find see if I could figure out the origin of this phrase. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I don't think Lost invented it. So I haven't found a clear answer yet because it's a phrase that's so often used that it's hard for me to find the source of it. But I found this interesting article about sort of suffering in the yogic Buddhist philosophy, concepts of that. And so I'm going to talk to you now about the five kleshas. Klesha is spelled K-L-E-S-H-A. Kleshas. The Sanskrit word klesha translates to poison or affliction. This term is used to denote our specific negative mental patterns that obscure our true nature. The kleshas are considered the cause of suffering in yogic and Buddhist philosophy and are to be actively overcome. The five kleshas are avidya, ignorance, asmita, egoism or I-amness, raga, attachment, dvesha, repulsion and aversion, and abhinivesha, I might have butchered that, fear of death and the will to live. And I think this has been really interesting reading about this, because I think if you look at our losties is on a our castaways on a journey to purge themselves of the suffering that their circumstances and their own emotional reactions to those circumstances have put them in, you can see them, some of them moving through you know, like ignorance. That's Sawyer, right? Mm-hmm. Moving through his ignorance. Or egoism. That is a very Jack thing. You know what I mean? Attachment. I don't know. You can figure out what you want to come from that. And then fear of death and the will to live. Like, that whole thing is like, that makes me think of Jack's ending,
mm-hmm.
where he's just like, and I died too. That last act of acceptance, which allows him to move on to the next level of whatever for Jack. I think it's interesting.
I think what's interesting is that there are thematic things that Lost does that can be interpreted sort of, you know, the way Kyle describes it in his email. I think where Lost sometimes gets itself in trouble is like they want to get up to the line where, you know, as we talked about in the last episode, where like Kate and Sawyer are making a decision that will literally cause suffering for them later, right? Like they are saving Ben, and their decision is what causes Ben to come back a little off, and it causes, you know, all the terrible things Ben does to them later. I think it works a little bit better as a thematic exercise than it does. There's like this extra hubris of, okay, we're doing time travel. Let's have them cause some of their own literal suffering. That I think, you know, whether or not the show would have been better without it is, you know, very subjective.
I don't mind genre fiction sort of literalizing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like
an emotional journey. You know,
they
what I mean?
Choose to literalize it, and I mean, honestly, it works okay for me. But then again, I'm a white guy, white male. Who's in the process of, you know, deprogramming a lot of that stuff in his life. So.
Kyle's not wrong. It's just my view of it is, picture you're strapped in room 23 and someone says, we are the cause of our own suffering. Who are you? Mm-hmm. You're other who's living by the island god's rules, who's been captured by, you know, Ben's others, or whatever reason, you know, for whatever reason you need, and you're being told that you are the reason you are suffering right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, that's the white male domination narrative, the colonialism narrative,
mm-hmm.
that makes we are the causes of our own suffering different from life is pain as a like philosophical way to try to get someone to shift their thing.
Sure. Well, and
you could be the head of a bank and tell somebody life is pain, and maybe you're trying to get through to them. If you're the head of a bank and you're like, well, you're the cause of your own suffering, I'm like, fuck you, head of bank.
I think Kyle acknowledged that in the end. He's like, he's not, I mean, we can disagree with Kyle's whole email and that's fine, but I think at the very end, like, I think I wouldn't have read Kyle's email if he hadn't had the part at the end where he's like, I'm not talking about the way in which like Republicans have mm-hmm. used this idea to advocate like bootstrapping and stuff like that, you know, which I appreciate. He's trying to make a distinction there, but I think the line is a little blurrier in this case. And I think this idea of like, I think I need to look a little bit more, because obviously like Lindelof, I don't know about Keyes, but obviously Lindelof is like someone called this an Old Testament show. I think one of our listeners emailed about that, which I really liked that description, but also like these ideas, these Eastern religion ideas are also sort of very much on their mind as they're discovering these things. And like The Leftovers is so much about like afterlife as well, and cycles determined by our own behavior and stuff like that, that I do think that that's something that Lindelof is constantly preoccupied mm-hmm. with. Like what brings us to enlightenment? What keeps us from that cycle of like birth and rebirth and, you know, being bound to a pattern of behavior?
I have one more thought on this. I think mm-hmm. that there is an impulse for Lost to want to also explore faith as a more general concept, and faith in the way that faith is used, and faith in the way that it is used to justify things, but also how it can be sort of perverted by the wrong kind of like leader. Cause like what we're seeing on the island is like, there is like a religion around Jacob. And so that scene in the camp where the other when Rob McElhenney gets knocked out and they rescue Carl is about the way some of that religion is being applied to the people who follow Jacob. And I think that there are interesting things to say about that. I don't know if Lost ever quite gets there, but Lost is very interested in the way that humans use, abuse, and misunderstand a lot because of faith, because they're taking things on faith. And I think that's interesting. There's a lot there to explore in all of human history, with the way faith and the way people use it to control other people at times.
Mm-hmm. John Locke antagonist corner. And for the person,
all right, speaking okay, go ahead.
Oh, I would just as a way out for the person who keeps tweeting at me asking if I'm serious about True Detective season 2 being the best season of True Detective, now's another time to ask yourself that question. Okay. Continue, Joanna.
It's Dave's worst opinion. I really like him though. Okay. All right. So one of our longest listeners, one of my original listener, Pat Spinagle, wrote us two epic length emails and acknowledged that they're both very long. And in one of them sort of helpfully tried to summarize his points for me along the way. Forgive me, Pat. I'm only going to read part of one of your emails, but it is still very long. So here we go. This is the one you refuse to summarize, and so I think it's the one that's the most important to you. First of all, Pat wanted to let us know he fell down multiple times in February.
Oh, no, Pat. Oh,
that's bad news, Barrett.
So sorry, buddy.
Yeah. All right, so this we're going to start here. Saeed, Sawyer, and Kate, the triple threat, and also Jack. Over the past weeks, we've approached season 6. There's been some storm discussion on how it's too bad that Sawyer's storyline was not all that great in season 6, or that Saeed's storyline was not that great in season 6, even to the point that speculation on an alternative universe where Sawyer died in the incident and Juliet survived to be on the island, or maybe Sun taking Sawyer's role as the person spending some time with the man in black in Locke, would have been superior to what we get with Saeed and Sawyer. I never want to tell people that they're wrong in how they feel, or that they're wrong to imagine other scenarios like this. I do want to suggest that Saeed and Sawyer are part of what I consider a satisfying three-part structure that plays out in the final season and should be appreciated. The character of the Man in Black, as Locke, is a disturbing figure, not just because he's a murderous genie, but he's so much like our Locke, who we have some emotional connection to, and it's weird seeing him as an actual monster. Jack sums this discomfort up when he appropriately chides the Man in Black for disrespecting Locke's memory. Locke, the real Locke, had forged through his actions on the island intense emotional connections with many of the Lost characters, and this plays out with some levels of satisfaction in season 6 as these characters interact with Locke's doppelganger. It's true that there is something off about Saeed after he's resurrected from the pool, but there's something very appropriate about him being given the assignment to stab the Man in Black with a magic dagger. There must be some part of Saeed that went, yes, finally, when given this assignment. There has been an unresolved issue between the pre-resurrected Saeed and the original Locke in season 1, ever since John clubs Saeed over the head during an attempt to track the island signal. Locke had no reasonable answer or actual defense when Saeed eventually called him out on the jungle carpet for it, and my head canon imagines Saeed getting some satisfaction of payback after that he was achieving something almost like resolution when he stabbed the Man in Black in Locke. Of course, that satisfaction for him was short-lived since this Locke is invulnerable to such damage, which establishes some of the stakes for us viewers. Locke is dangerous because he was immune to Saeed's attack, and Saeed, despite Dojin's good/evil meter readings, is very good. If international assassin Saeed can't kill Monster Locke with a magic dagger, how can fake Locke be stopped? Saeed establishes part one of the three-part scenario that the Man in Black is dangerous at an unforeseen level. Sawyer spends time with this demon Locke, and it's important to remember that the original Locke and Sawyer shared an emotionally important time at the Black Rock when Locke locked Sawyer up with Locke's dad, resulting in Sawyer taking violent revenge on the man who ruined his life. There are a few people on the cast of Lost that really can claim such a relationship, and it's something that is present between Sawyer and the man who looks like Locke. Like Jack, Sawyer must have some grudging respect for the old Locke and probably still harbors some resentment at the situation Locke put him through, a resentment that is reasonable to harness against the Man in Black. Sawyer might not have ever acted on that resentment with a real human Locke, but in human Locke, he has no reason to get positive support from Sawyer. During a canoe trip from the main island to the Hydra Island, Sawyer interrogates Locke on why he doesn't just fly to Hydra Island as a cloud of smoke. Locke doesn't provide details but implies that he can't, which fired up the viewer's imagination that the water might possibly be a weakness for the smoke monster. Usually Hurley is the audience surrogate, but Sawyer steps into that role in this regard, concluding, in sync with viewer theories, that he's discovered Locke's kryptonite. Late in the season, Sawyer forcibly knocks Locke off the submarine dock, hoping that this unexpected dunking will have a catastrophic effect on the island monster. Locke emerges from the water, dripping and angry, and that was legit terrifying. The two most dangerous characters, they arguably are the most dangerous, on the island, had tried to take out the Man in Black, one acting on explicit advice, Magic Dagger, and one on implicit hypothesis, Water, and both had failed. The Man in Black now seemed truly invulnerable. I'm telling you, this is only part of Pat's email, and I'm not even done yet. Okay. This was calculated to make the situation seem hopeless, so we'd be surprised when the true monster slayer and hero of Lost defeats Locke. I'm talking about Kate shooting a vulnerable Locke before he could finish off Jack, who was only there as a distraction. Jack was supposed to die off in the first episode, leaving Kate to be the big hero of Lost. It just took Jack 6 seasons to die, and he got to witness his Kate's AON I am no man moment from Return of the King. This email is already too long, so we'll send some follow-up email about Kate and how she was underestimated by the Man in Black to his detriment. Anyway, the triple attempts on the Man in Black, starting with Sayid, followed up by Sawyer, and third time's the charm, Kate, is something that I would not want to change. Even though Sawyer and Sayid are relegated to secondary characters in the 6th season, I appreciate their participation in building up the threat of the Man in Black. TLDR, if you used to summarize the above thesis. Best regards and namaste, Pat.
TLDR, LOL, Pat.
So, you know, some compelling stuff there from Pat. What do you guys think?
I like it. Like everything that I've, you know, heard from Pat. It's hard to disagree with things that are well thought out and well argued. However, I think you could still have all those things in the last season and make those characters better. Like, I think he pointed out how those characters are properly used in the 6th season. I don't have too much of a gripe about Magic Knife, Sawyer versus Locke. Actually, Sawyer hanging out with fake Locke is probably the best stuff in 6th season that happens on the island, as far as I'm concerned. I think. Yeah. Like the jokes about the cave and stuff.
There's some good Claire stuff. Not like, I don't love all the Claire stuff, but like the Claire and Kate stuff is kind of good for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, point being, I think there was room where we could have accurately built up Flock as this unkillable thing, which they do, to have Kate eventually shoot him, but also do it in a way that made me like the Sayid character more. He just takes a bomb and runs into off the show.
It's a bummer. It's a bummer.
And then you don't even have a time to like mourn him because the son and Jin happen immediately afterwards.
It's not great. And like you just can't help but think if they like got rid of a lot of that, if they just stripped out a lot of that temple garbage, we'd have more time for those things.
Sayid would have wanted to kill fake Locke anyway.
Right. Exactly.
Sayid could have gotten there without the muddy water.
And Sayid didn't have to be like, I think actually would have been really great. let's 10 years later quarterback the end of Lost. If Sayid, like his point is right. International assassin Sayid tries to kill a Locke with a magic dagger and fails. It's upsetting. Mm-hmm. What if he fails so hard he dies? I mean, Locke can't kill the fake Locke can't kill the candidates is the problem, but like if him trying to kill Locke resulted in his death and that happened and we'd be so upset, right?
and it
would carry even more of an impact of like Sayid not only failed, he failed to death, and he didn't need to like get, he never needed to be Locke's thrall, because all he does is Locke's thrall is like go look for Desmond in a well and like not find him and then like or like not, I don't know. It's confusing. The whole like Desmond's in a well and Sayid has to go find him is all bad as far as I'm concerned. So I don't know. Do it better. The Sawyer stuff is pretty good. You know, it's just, and his sideways stuff is, you know, very good. So there is that. Does Sayid get a good, Sayid gets an okay sideways thing. It's a naughty episode. It's okay. It's a naughty episode, but he still ends up with Shannon Y. Okay, anyway.
Every time you try to make it okay, you remember another thing about how Saeed ends on this show, and it gets a little less okay.
Season 6 is going to be wild, y'all.
His Nadia episode is, like, good, where he played, like, Nadia's married to his brother, and it's, like, this whole thing, and they've got this, like, attraction, but, like, he's the brother, and there's all this stuff. And then, like, Kimi's there, and that's fun, and he discovers Jin in the deep freeze. Like, that's all fun. And you know, you get, like, fun Saeed assassin shit, but, like, man... Was the actress who played Nadia just busy? Why wasn't she there in the show?
Because she was never on the island. They should have brought Nadia to the island if they wanted
Penny
her so bad.
Penny never technically made it onto the island. Penny's in the goddamn church.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the church. We're going to have to do a whole episode about the damn church.
Penny was always at least several miles offshore. So, you know.
All right.
Okay, I'm sorry, I forgot. Pew, 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 I'm in charge of the storm. Yeah. All right, is there anything else we want to say about Some Like It Hoth? This episode, how we would rewrite Star Wars, how this one is clearly the Death Star.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the Star Wars parts of our conversation will never end, but I think we might be done with the
also,
Lost
stuff. Also, we did, I feel like maybe we talked about this off, or maybe we got close to it in the calm. Was the idea that Miles' dad is not the worst dad. Like, he ends...
We continue to
learn more about how Pierre Chang sort of saved his family, right?
No, but Pierre Chang gets to be a straight-up hero by the end of the season. And, like, that's why it was kind of tough for Dave to ask that prompt, because we know the answer. But we can't say it. But yeah, no, Pierre Chang is definitely not a bad... He would lose the bad dad Olympics.
But for everybody listening in the storm, we just keep it... It's just a couple more weeks.
Well...
that's the finale,
what I love,
right?
Yeah, but what I love is that next week when when Faraday shows up, he's like... He has Miles with him and he just like walks up to... He walks up to Pierre Chang and he's just like... Miles is your son. He just says it. And then he's like, think about it. A Chinese American man with the same name as your son just happens to show up and you're like, Dan. Oh my God. Oh. Also,
you gotta be at Time
week,
Daddy level in order to say stuff like that.
Time Daddy. Speaking of Time Daddy, candidate for worst wig coming up next week.
Oh yeah.
Next week.
That's true. We have
the
more bad
wig
wigs
parade
as
continues.
And the origin, I mean, and a journal origin story. What more could you ask for?
Hey, we have a casual causal loop, so let's not all throw away. Time Daddy delivers.
No, I mean, Time Daddy definitely delivers. I think the reason I don't mean to like eat into us talking about the variable, but I think the reason his jumpsuit changes, I'll have to like look at when it does, is because he was wearing that other jumpsuit in the cold open of the season.
Mm.
Yes.
He's wearing just like a gray Dharma regular.
So it's more of a
Dharma jumpsuit.
Consistency issue.
I think maybe even by the time we see him in next week's episode, he's out of the blacks, which is too bad because you're right.
Yeah,
the black.
That's the best one.
It's a fun wrinkle. And I know. Okay, we're just doing next week's podcast. Let's. Anything else we want to talk about this week?
No, I think we're good. I mean, we really want to talk about Time Daddy, but we'll get there.
Time Daddy, I missed you. All right, do we do the thing at the end of the week where we tell people where they can find us?
Well, first we go, until next week. Neil, where are we going on Lost?
No, it's my job now.
Okay, yeah.
You talked about this Patreon Slack. I'll do this. Hey, until next time, Neil, where are we going next?
Well,
Lost?
We are going to the 100th episode, as Dave mentioned earlier in the pod. It's The Variable. It's the one about Daniel. It's the one about we're going to have to do a mom antagonist check-in with this one just to see how we feel about her at the end of this. It's going to be fun. It's a very good episode of Lost.
Yeah, speaking of ticking clocks, Daniel Faraday has one more day left.
Right.
Yeah, one more day on the island.
Until he gets to go to heaven and wear a hat and play jazz forever. okay. Okay, until then, Neil Miller, where can folks find you?
Well, you know, you can always get me over at the filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter @rejects or @oneperfectshot. Those are good spots. And we announced, I announced this as the day we recorded this, that on April 6th in the Slack, the Stream Together Watch Alone project is going to celebrate the 1 year anniversary of the stream, the live watch, the daily live watch.
What?
Yeah, oh, April God. 6th of 2020, we started Breaking Bad.
What is this year?
And so we're going to do Legend of Korra, two episodes a day. It's going to take up most of April. It's going to be fun. I've never seen it. Can't wait to watch it. Just bought it on Blu-ray. And so, yeah, join our Patreon, patreon.com/stormofspoilers. Jump in the Slack and watch Korra with us.
Neil Miller, I'm about to tell you that you have such Bolin energy, and that is just like the highest compliment I can say.
Okay. All right. Can't wait to find out what that means.
Bolin, my favorite.
Talking about right, true love, Babu.
And yeah, Neil and his dogs is definitely definitely Cat Daddy Pabu. All right, Bolin. All right, and Dave Gonzalez, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @DA7E. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, talking about pop culture. And if you're streaming together and watching alone with Neil Miller, you might want to pop open your iTunes and search the podcasts for Republic City Dispatch, which will have your not Neil hosts right, talking about Korra.
Yeah, and Patches, right? Patches
and Patches and Devendra Hardaway.
Patches and Devendra Hardaway.
Oh, I like both of those people.
My name is Joanna Robinson. You can find me on Twitter. I wrote this. You can find me on VanityFair.com. I do a podcast called Still Watching. We're covering Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So yeah, those are places you can find me. And Dave, do you have one more thing to maybe to say to our listeners before we go?
Yeah, it's very important, even if you're Pat and you have already failed, that you not fall down.